Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Rock and pearl is nice and cool. So juicy, sweet, catch a fish. So juicy, sweet.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Cognitive Recalibration Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Shravan. We don't have Tyron here with us. I was almost going to do my normal intro there, and here's Tyron. But no, he's I don't actually know what he's up to today. We've got our replacement for Tyron.
It's Basker.
I thought it was going to be you.
Yeah. Tyron was saying you're his replacement. So,
hey, everyone. Isn't that what he says? Isn't that his intro?
Yeah, it's usually just, hey, everyone. Yeah.
In his really deep voice.
So welcome, Kiridi, and welcome, Basker. Basker's back from our Fellowship of the Ring
episode. Hi, everyone. Good to be back. It's been a while. I feel like it's been a long time since we did Fellowship.
It has been a while, yeah. And even
4 weeks. Since 3 weeks.
3 weeks. And even since we watched Two Towers, I think it's been a little bit.
Yeah, it's been a while, but it's still fresh.
Yes.
And apologies in advance. I got a very nasally voice because I've come down with a bit of a Gollum fever. If anything, it'll help my Gollum impression, which I might crack out towards the end of the show. So here we go.
Do the whole podcast
in Gollum voice. No, precious. No, not gonna be good.
You know, Andy Serkis does the audible version of Lord of the Rings, so he narrates the whole book.
Yeah.
So he does all the, obviously he does the Gollum voice.
Yeah, he goes full character. Yeah. So it's so cool.
That'd be dope.
So obviously we're talking about Two Towers today, Lord of the Rings Two Towers, as a follow-up from our Fellowship of the Ring episode. And before we get into anything, I wanted to talk about TikTok and Instagram. So obviously, we posted some stuff on TikTok recently, and it's got a lot of traction. So we definitely know who gave the swords to Merry and Pippin.
Oh, yeah. If people have been watching and they're just waiting for a correction, yeah, we know.
It was exactly what Pudgy said.
Yes.
Pretty much, yeah. Because we are
It was not Tom Bombadil. That can go fuck himself.
We're obviously reviewing the movies and the details are from the films, which are inspired from the books. It's a good time to get like feedback. And I actually like the fact that people are watching those reels and commenting on it, even if they think it's not correct. Please engage with us and let us know. Yeah.
It's good. I think people getting triggered by opinions is pretty funny. And so I would encourage more of it.
If you haven't followed us on Instagram or TikTok yet, go ahead and do so because we're posting more stuff on there now.
Hopefully controversial stuff.
Yes, let's see what comes out of this episode. So we'll do a bit of background on the movie. And we actually didn't talk much about the books last time in terms of when they were written, all of that stuff. So I'll talk a little bit about that.
Yeah.
And then we'll talk a little bit about Peter Jackson, actually, in terms of his career and where what's happened post Lord of the Rings. And then we'll jump into
nothing. Nothing of value.
Well, there's not much to talk about there. And then we'll jump into our thoughts on the movie.
Well, here's a question. You're going to start off with the books? You're going to just start off with the movie?
Start with the movie. Okay. We'll just touch on the books where we think it's relevant.
Let me know when you're going to start trivia about the actual books.
Okay.
Because I've got a question for you. I think Vasco already knows this question. He might know this answer. I think I've had this discussion with him. But
okay. Yeah, we do have a trivia section later at the end, so we'll do it then.
Yeah, yeah. Or if during the recap, if the question's like hitting a particular point in the narrative, you can then just bring it up.
Absolutely will not bring it up.
Okay, so Two Towers came out in 2002.
20 years ago.
When did the first one come out? 2001?
2001.
Yeah, 2001.
Yeah. So it premiered on the 5th of December. Came out for us on the 26th of December.
Boxing Day.
Runtime is 179 minutes for the theatrical version, 223 minutes for the extended version, which is the one.
Oh, shit.
Wait, so theatrical is close to 3 hours?
Yeah.
Wow. I don't remember that.
Yeah, but extended is nearly 4 hours. That's mental.
Yeah. I don't remember it's worth it, theatrical being that long. I'm not surprised, though. I'm not surprised at all.
And we watched the extended edition, so we're going to be commenting on that as well.
Yep.
Budget was $94 million. Which again was similar to sort of Fellowship levels. Box office wise, what do you guys think it made?
So Fellowship, we predicted.
So Fellowship was just like under $1 billion in 2001.
In 2001.
Yeah.
Yeah. Two Towers is going to be more.
1.5.
I'd say 1.3.
Is it less?
It's less. So it was still less than $1 billion. So it was $947 million. So it was similar to Fellowship.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah. All right.
But adjusted for inflation, $1.4 billion.
Oh, there you go. Right.
I'm surprised it didn't make as much as The Fellowship. It's far more interesting.
Sequels generally tend to suffer from that curse of like not having as much attention, media-wise as well. It's like it's relying on the people who watched the first one.
Yeah.
I guess maybe initial release and then
subsequent.
Just like
kind of, yeah. And there's not including DVD sales and all that kind of stuff as well. So.
That's right. Yeah. Yes, yes.
Game sales. Game sales. Oh, Xbox game sales.
Yeah. So books-wise, Fellowship was released on the 29th of July, 1954. So that's when it was published. Two Towers was published on the 11th of November in the same year. So 6 months later.
Yep.
And then Return of the King was a year later. So 20th of October, 1955. So they were all released like within a year.
I reckon he kind of, so
I'm he must sure have wrote all of them.
Yeah, he wrote them all at once. Yeah.
He didn't actually want to separate them into three. He wanted to release The Lord of the Rings as a book. The publishers were the ones who told Tolkien, this was also during post-World War II, where paper was crazy expensive. And A, it would be really expensive to print a massive, like, encyclopedic volume of Lord of the Rings. And B, no one would buy it because it's just too expensive and too big. So he had to be convinced to break it down into three. And then the naming of the three, it was like, oh, okay.
That's right.
He had a bit of a trek about that.
And on that, so there is speculation as to why this one was called Two Towers and which Two Towers it's actually referring to in the book. So according to him, he settled on Orthanc and Minas Morgul in terms of the books.
Right. They're so the tower towers. In Isengard and the tower in Minas Morgul, which is right next to the Morgul Vale.
It's the border of Mordor and Gondor.
Correct.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's opposite Minas Tirith, right? Because that's essentially the border. Minas Tirith faces Minas Morgul.
Yeah.
Well, what did it used to be called? It used to be called something else.
Yeah, it when it was
I know this because of the games.
Yeah, it had a name Shadow before Mordor. It was taken.
Minas something. It was Minas something else.
Minas.
Yeah.
Ithil.
Minas Ithil?
I think so.
Is it?
Yeah.
City of Moon?
Yeah.
That's what it means.
I don't know. Ithil? Is that what Ithil means?
Ithil means moon, yeah. Ah. In
shouldn't I say that?
Sindarin.
Oh, you're just reading your notes. Are you just reading your notes?
Yeah, just reading my notes. But I did read that it was called, so that was when it was inhabited by men, but then it got taken over by Mordor.
Yeah.
That's when it became Minas Morgul.
Well, because I know in Shadow of Mordor, Shadow of War, you're actually there and you're with the men that are defending it and you're kind of, because you're working in that at that time. And so it's really interesting because you don't realize where you actually are and then it gets taken over by Sauron's forces and you're like, oh my God, this is Minas Morgul. I didn't realize.
So you're correct. It was called Minas Ithil.
Yeah, there you go.
And it was the Tower of the South. So it was once occupied by Isildur before it was taken over by the Nazgul.
There you go.
Yeah, interesting.
Tolkien came up with the title under a deadline and later expressed dissatisfaction with the title because he was forced to come up with something last minute.
Yeah, and he was pretty dissatisfied with coming up with the name for the last one as well.
Return of the King.
I think that was a publisher suggestion and he didn't want to name it Return of the King because it was like, that's spoiling the whole story. So he didn't want to call it that at all.
Well, how old was I when Return of the King came out? I was like maybe 13. When did Return of the King come out? 2003.
Right after, yeah. Year,
oh, really? Year after this, yeah.
Oh, okay, so I was 11. I thought Return of the King was very, it was a good name because it's ambiguous.
Yeah.
And also I wasn't very, back then, I wasn't very focused on the fact that Aragorn was supposed to be king. I was like, shit, Sauron's going to come back. That's what I was thinking. I was like, you know, he's the Dark King or whatever.
Well, yeah. when you say in the whole title, The Lord of the Rings, it's talking about Sauron, The Return of the King, it sounds pretty dark.
Yeah.
I remember thinking the same thing. This sounds sinister slash it could be hopeful. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's not confirmed yet.
Yes, but it was the last one. So I was thinking maybe it's probably not Sauron. I was thinking, and on a really tragic note. And further to your point about paper costs, so Tolkien also produced a final cover illustration showing the two towers. But the publisher decided not to use it in order to save money.
Wow. There you go.
They just shat all over him, essentially.
It'd be really cool if if there's still a Tolkien version of that book hidden somewhere with Christopher Tolkien's vault.
Yeah.
Because that'd be worth, like, it's a priceless relic if that exists.
Actually, I mean, we're kind of talking, we're alluding to the topic that I was going to kind of raise anyway. Yeah. Do you know how, we spoke about this, but do you know how he came up, you know what the story is behind him coming up with Lord of the Rings or how it all started? So Tolkien... this is post-war. I think he was an English teacher and he was marking all these essays because I just watched this on some documentary. And if you're a teacher, you'll probably realize, I don't know how many teachers you have listening to this podcast, but after probably the third paper or third essay that you're correcting, it gets really boring. So he was getting really bored at what he was receiving and he thought it was all shit and it was all rubbish. And then someone really did not give a shit and they handed him a blank piece of paper as their essay and he loved it. And in the excitement of not having to correct anything, because it's a blank piece of paper, he just wrote, "There once was a hole and in it lived a hobbit." And that's kind of, and then all of a sudden he just came up with the story and that was it. That's kind of how it all started. Yeah.
Yeah.
So just out of the boredom of this English teacher that really didn't want to mark any essays.
And there was a story around his child. He used to like get a sign off from Christopher, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like he used to let his child read it. Before he published it.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, that's how The Hobbit, I'm pretty sure the way The Hobbit worked for the first few years was it was a story that he read to his kids. Like,
correct.
And read to his family. And I think people, immediates knew about it. And then only when he, I'm not sure about how the particular publishing worked and stuff, but then it kind of became this other thing. But
I think Christopher convinced him to publish it because I think he didn't initially want to.
Yeah. So, I think from what I remember was Christopher was asking Tolkien questions all the time and it'd be like, oh, but then how did Bilbo get the sword or where did he go? Where did the dwarves come from? And he was asking so many questions that Tolkien got frustrated and wrote a book so that it's like, okay, I have a facts listed down so you can't ask me questions that I trip up. You can't trip me up anymore. So like that's how he started with The Hobbit. And then he started with that and then it's like I've always wondered what is in the mind of someone who creates such a big world.
Yeah.
Like, did he have these things in the back and he wanted to connect them, or did he have this underlying desire of like, because he had this? We talked about this in the first podcast. He wanted to create a mythos for England. Did he wind that passion into his storytelling, or was that the plan from the beginning of saying I want to create this epic work? I feel like it's something that's organic. It's just something that evolves. No one can plan for such a epic world because he created languages, he created cultures.
I think it's happened later. I think after people have been inspired by him and his writings, then like Rowling kind of, she came up, once she figured out the idea for a story, it just all came to her and then she kind of fleshed it out. I think once people already have this idea in their mind that you can create these worlds like Tolkien did, then they have a less organic, to an extent, process of fleshing it all out. But I think for him, it was like this journey of also discovery of his own mind or how am I going to, this is a story I've created for my kids. How am I going to support all this stuff? You know, it's pretty funny. I find it pretty funny that The Hobbit, I mean, yeah, in Lord of the Rings, it's about hobbits, but it's about so many other characters that we find really powerful, but it all just started with this random thought of there's a hobbit.
Yeah.
It's really let's figure it out from there.
It's really fascinating. A kid's book, and then it expanded to much more than that.
Yeah.
Anything else on the books?
I know nothing else about the books, to be honest.
One thing on the books that I'll mention is this film, there's a lot going on in this film. And I think the reason why is because if anyone's read The Two Towers, it starts off it's basically about two volumes, The Two Towers, because The Lord of the Rings, what Tolkien was planning to do was write like six volumes and put it into one big book. But because he had to separate it, Two Towers has essentially two storylines. So it starts off with Aragorn, Legolas, Gimli, their storyline chasing after Merry and Pippin and eventually going into another character's plotline. And then it goes through their entire storyline, finishes the entire storyline for Two Towers, for their arc, stops, rewinds the time, the clock back, goes and follows Frodo and Sam's journey. And then they go off until they reach literally beyond the scope of the movie in Two Towers. Shelob's Lair and all that kind of stuff technically comes under Two Towers in the book. But the way that the books were constructed, it's a bit of like a time rewind. So I actually think the movie is a superior storytelling narrative because it actually stitches in all these arcs.
Yeah. So that's where George R. R. Martin got it from then. Because he does that in his books.
Yeah, right? Yeah, where he goes back.
He separates it. Yep. Yeah, like part one is a story and then part two, you're going back to the timeline at the start of part one of the previous book and it's a different person's perspective and some people are totally left out of a certain book. For pretty a reason. Much. Like Bran never ever comes back in like some of the books that he's written. So it's very similar to, I mean, he's clearly influenced by Tolkien. So
it must have been influenced by a lot of that writing. And you could tell from the books that Tolkien had a real challenge on his hands for syncing up events because it's like the only reason why we know the time was rewound was when all the events happen in Two Towers, stops, goes back. And then it goes on to Frodo and Sam's storyline with Gollum and Smeagol, all that kind of stuff. But towards the end, when they're climbing up Minas, when they're climbing up the stairs next to Minas Morgul.
Cirith Ungol.
Cirith Ungol, yeah, the stairs to Cirith Ungol. It's like they can see the battle of Minas Tirith happening as they're climbing up, which is events in Return of the King.
Yeah.
So the time flow is kind of really whacked out.
Oh,
And all that happens in Two Towers for Sam in the Frodo. Book. So Sam and Frodo.
Oh, that would have been epic to see that in the movie. That would have been awesome.
They kind of do. So when Minas Morgul lights up, it's like that one event that syncs up
and then the multiple storylines. Nazgul's.
Yeah, but that happens in Return of the King. Tower. That's in the books it happens for Frodo and Sam in Two Towers. So it's interesting seeing how all that sync up. So there was a lot of challenge for the filmmakers to kind of cut and find out like, well, which scenes are we going to put into the Two Towers?
Yeah.
So yeah.
Because there was some scenes in Fellowship that were from Two Towers, the book.
Correct. Like the death of Boromir.
Yeah.
That happens in the beginning of Two Towers for Aragorn and Legolas and Gimli's storyline. So this was definitely a challenge.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, this was a huge challenge for the filmmakers to fit in. It was much more busier, and I think in the pace of the film, it shows.
On the movie, actually, I think Infinity War might have had some inspiration from this movie because Infinity War, there's multiple characters again doing different things at the same time in the parallel.
Correct. And they're all grouped.
Similar sort of thing happens in this movie, and I guess to a lesser extent in the next movie because they start coming back together in the next movie. But I think Infinity War might have had some inspiration from the way they shot this movie.
Good point. Yeah.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
On that, so Peter Jackson. So before Lord of the Rings, he did a lot of very small budget New Zealand-based films, and then he did Lord of the Rings, and then after Lord of the Rings that he's directed. So in 2005 he did King Kong, which was another big budget movie, and then he did a movie called Crossing the Line, which was a short film. Then he did The Lovely Bones.
Yes.
Yeah. Which was a theatrical release. He was a producer on The Adventures of Tintin, the animated movie. And then he did the Hobbit trilogy. And then after the Hobbit trilogy, he hasn't directed a theatrical movie, but he has directed three documentaries.
Yes.
So two Beatles documentaries and one documentary called They Shall Not Grow Old, which is about World War II.
Yeah.
Interesting. Is he a massive Beatles fan? Or he must be, right?
He must be.
I definitely feel like his slowdown is a result of burnout. Like looking at how The Lord of the Rings was planned out really meticulously and he knew exactly what he wanted to do. He wrote the story from beginning to end. Scripting, storyboarding was all done. The Hobbit was nowhere near as planned.
Well, he was forced to direct that actually because he was initially just a producer and then Guillermo del Toro was meant to direct it.
He did want to do it. I feel like he didn't have the same planning as he did for Lord of the Rings. So he wasn't anticipating that he was going to do it. So if anyone's watched Desolation of Smaug, if it feels, or Battle of Five Armies for that matter, if it feels a bit disconnected and a bit like, oh, what's going on? That's exactly what Peter Jackson felt during the making of the film. He was just like lost at some point saying, I don't know how to connect these storylines or how to make this. Like the Battle of Five Armies is like a couple of pages in The Hobbit. Bilbo's actually knocked unconscious. And by the time he wakes up, the battle's done, over. Yeah, that's what happens. Because Tolkien couldn't write epic war scenes at that time in The Hobbit.
Yeah.
So he just wrote, here comes the Elvish army. Here comes the Dwarvish army. Here's a thing. He slips, knocks his head, wakes up, and shit's happened. It's funny how that relates back to his burnout, which is unfortunate because he's a wonderful director.
Yeah.
I'd love to see him. My pipe dream to this day is The Silmarillion somehow represented on TV or movie done by Peter Jackson in part or in full.
Yeah.
Which would be amazing.
Apparently they tried to consult him for this Amazon show, but he kind of refused to get involved.
No, it was the other way around.
Oh, he wanted to.
So initially the Amazon guys were doing it, expressed interest in reaching out. They did reach out, and Peter Jackson actually said, I'm happy to talk to you or consult whenever you guys want to.
They didn't call him back, though.
They never called him back.
Yeah, that's right. That's
yeah.
Right. Yeah.
They never called him back, which is like, okay, it's fair enough. I would have – it's kind of left the fans a bit salty as a result, like saying here's someone who's done an established body of work. You don't even want to hear what he's done. On the other hand, I kind of respect the guys, people, whoever's behind Rings of Power, all the creative team, the directors. They want their own representation. They want to have their own mark in the sand, which after watching all the episodes, I'm like, you know what? Good on them for doing their own
thing. And it's not connected to his movies. It's its own.
No, not connected to his movies. So, yeah. But I think.
I think that is yet to be established. It's very hard to know. They say that, yeah, they don't have the rights to material in the movies.
There are some references.
They are referencing. They're straight up saying the name Sauron. They're saying all these terms.
Yeah.
And so now I don't think anyone actually knows how much they're allowed to reference or whether they're actually just trying to keep it as separate as possible, but even they may be allowed some sort of reference. I don't know what's going on.
I think the team behind the Rings of Power series, which we're like foreshadowing all kinds of stuff that we're going to be talking about
yes.
in the future.
Yeah.
There's a lot of...
halfway through, by the way. So season four... Episode four has just been released.
Yeah. There's... appearances of swords in scenes in Numenor that look a lot like Narsil. So, like, they're obviously referencing Peter Jackson's work visually to some extent, but how much of that goes into...
Oh, yeah, 100%. Narsil was in that last episode.
Yeah. It's
in the Sword of
Elendil. There's links. It would have been nice if they just called him and said, you know what, we'll do it on our own. So thanks for the offer, Peter Jackson. We're not going to...
Yeah.
But it doesn't take much. Professional courtesy is underrated.
Who knows? Who actually knows what's happened? Huh?
Yeah.
Could
have been Peter Jackson. Should have been like, fuck you guys, I don't want to talk to you. Who knows?
Could be.
All right, well, let's jump into our thoughts on the Two Towers movie. We'll do positives and negatives, and then we'll jump into spoilers. Yeah. So we can start with your positives, Bhaskar.
I just wanted to say that this movie has one of the most powerful openings of any film I've ever watched. One of the most powerful. So watch this film, man. If you just want to, like...
Opening? Wait.
The opening film. The opening of this film. Yeah.
What is the opening of this film?
Gandalf?
Well, it's like the screen opens up pans of like the mountains of Moria. And then it goes straight back into the
flashback. Yeah.
But it's also a really, really good... It's a good story. It's a good story. Like the Fellowship's been fractured into three. It's how do you follow the narratives of three separate groups? It's a really high challenge. But this film does a really beautiful job. And it has a really good climactic finish, which is very different to me, like to Fellowship in the way that it starred itself as well. So wonderful acting, a great ensemble of actors, really, really good ensemble of actors. And for like fans of the lore and like the general expanse of Middle-earth, this movie shows no fewer than 8 separate cultures of Middle-earth. And I'll list them out in the spoiler talk. But there's like 8 separate civilizations that you see in this movie. Like species. It's really cool.
Yeah. What are your thoughts? I know this is your favorite.
Yeah, I think this is my favorite movie. I think it's just so underrated. I feel like everyone thinks about The Fellowship, everyone thinks about Return of the King. But I think the meat of this, at least in the movies, the meat of it is all in this movie. I think things like some awesome things happen at the end of The Fellowship, i.e. the splitting of The Fellowship. And then it's like deep concepts into who Boromir is and kind of the race of man as opposed to Numenoreans and where they stand. And then this movie actually goes into where these characters come from. There's a bit more background into all this stuff. I mean, at least in the extended edition there is. I think they might have cut quite a bit out in the normal. Yeah, I agree with everything you said. There's a new species introduced. There's like... worldly concepts. There's some of the greatest quotes in this movie from it's Merry, I'm pretty sure. It has like one of my favorite quotes, which I go into in the spoiler talk. But I just feel like a lot of the intentions, a lot of redemption, a lot of core concepts of the what this trilogy is and what this overall Lord of the Rings is happens in this movie. And I think that people, well, at least I did, I kept thinking that Return of the King is when everything happened and Fellowship was really boring. But then when I rewatched it after a long time, after I went to, what's that place called? Hobbiton?
Yeah.
Hobbiton, Lord of the Rings. Yeah. In New Zealand.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. Then I rewatched it on, after I went to Hobbiton, I rewatched it and I was like, oh my God, how, like, Two Towers is 100% my favorite. So, yeah.
Nice.
No, really
nice. Enjoyed. Nice.
I agree with everything that's been said as well. One thing that hasn't been mentioned is the motion capture technology that they use for Gollum.
Yeah.
In this, which was.
Is it better than.
Well, is he in the first one? No, you don't really see Gollum in the first one. So
see his eyes in Khazad Dûm.
Yeah, all depictions of Gollum in Fellowship were all CGI. Yeah, all computer generated. Nothing was mo-capped.
So Andy Serkis was one of his first, I think maybe his first mo-cap role might be in that. Because they didn't really do mocap before that, so
yeah, he was a voice actor before he started acting.
Yeah,
and this was meant to be a voice acting gig.
That's right.
It wasn't until they got into the, oh, how do we depict this goat dude? They started using him in the scenes as a stand-in.
Yeah,
and then he actually fought for his own case, saying, "I would prefer it if the actors looked at me and interacted with me during the scenes." And then, yeah, it was an evolutionary process. He eventually became the mocap actor.
Yeah, apparently they asked him to come to London to do the voice acting.
Yep.
And while he was doing the voice acting, he like acted like Gollum.
Yep.
And then Peter Jackson saw that and he's like, we need to get him on the sets. And then once they got him on the sets, they're like, well, he's basically doing the role. It's just he doesn't look like Gollum, but he's doing
they're it. They're full savage. Have you seen those scenes where they put it like it's freezing outside and they make him wear like this
skin tight,
this jumpsuit. Yeah, yeah. And he's literally, he's freezing and then, and he's like crawling through rocks in a stream. And like, yes,
this is the scene where he's trying to chase the fish.
Yeah,
right?
Trying to face it. Yeah. And he's not even like, oh, just crawling. Man, he's like jumping and belly flopping onto jagged rocks on South Island. It's like, dude, he has a death wish. This is mental.
And in South Island, that river actually has, goes off on a waterfall just 10 meters down. Like, well, you know how he's going down river?
Yeah, yeah.
There's a waterfall drop. So if you see them making off scenes, he actually stops and he puts himself on a rock and Peter Jackson's like, all right, Andy, be careful. There's a ledge.
Yeah, people are freaking out.
But his performance was captured in that and they used the exact motions he did to make like Smeagol do the exact same leg flop so the splashes come out right. It's really cool how he was brought on for something and he ended up becoming Gollum.
Yeah, and like becoming fully. Like the motion capture guy because then after that he did Planet of the Apes other stuff. So
all kinds of stuff. And he came back for The Hobbit as well.
Yeah. So that was really standout. And all the sequences with Gollum, for me, I'm kind of jumping into negatives or mixed a little bit. I thought the Frodo and Sam elements of this movie, not that much happens in their storyline.
Worst part of the whole trilogy, in my opinion.
Yeah, between them two. There's a bit of friction.
Yeah, apart from if Gollum wasn't part of those proceedings, I think it would have been a bit boring. Because Gollum was in them, they became one of the more interesting parts in the whole movie. I can talk about I think the Aragorn parts are probably the most interesting parts for me. The least interesting parts, which is kind of my negatives, and this becomes more, I guess, a bit more exaggerated in the extended editions, are the Ent section.
Yep.
It does slow down the pace of the movie, especially in the extended editions, and not just because they talk slow, because
I think that's intentional.
Yeah, it's intentional.
It's supposed to be frustratingly slow.
Yeah.
It's like, wow, there's so much going on. The ants are just these creatures that just could not give a flying fandango.
Yeah. I know exactly what you mean. It's like there's a reason why they cut most of the scenes from that part of the narrative from the theatrical edition.
Yeah, that's right. So whereas with the Fellowship, I thought the extended edition makes sense. I would probably keep everything in the extended edition. In this, I can understand why they cut out some of those scenes because it was kind of, affecting the flow of the film. That was kind of my only negative. I think it's a slower film than the other two, and that's why I still put put it third because it's slow in terms of the action. There's only one real big action sequence, which is one of the best action sequences in the whole trilogy, the Helm's Deep sequence. The rest of the film is a little bit slow. It's much more about character building moments, which are still really good. But for me, I really enjoy. We start to watch Return of the King again, but I think it used to be Return of the King first. I still put Fellowship above this, slightly, and then this. But obviously, they're all amazing.
Yeah. You bastard.
That's very interesting because I thought when they splintered the group into three, the pacing instantly became much more effective because instead of one group going on this long journey and you have to have these slow moments of like, okay, Council of Elrond or Mines of Moria where they're sitting down and discussing where they are.
Yeah.
In this one, the moment one storyline gets a little bit too slow or they have a bit of an argument, yeah, they go immediately back to like, okay, Gandalf, what happened to Gandalf? Like Frodo and Sam are still reeling from his death. And then it goes straight back into like, okay, Aragorn and Gimli and Legolas. Like the beginning of that film is really chop, chop, chop. Like they're chasing Merry and Pippin.
Yeah.
And then
mainly because I found the Frodo storyline and the Ent storyline just not as interesting. Every time they switch back to this,
yeah,
I was like, I'd rather spend a bit more time with Aragorn and what he's up to or even Gandalf because he kind of appears in the middle of this movie as well. So
yeah. I said Gandalf before and I was just immediately pivoted to like, oh, his death and how it, instead of spoiling the fact that he turns in this film. But
they actually spoiled Gandalf in the trailer.
In the trailer, yeah. Which is stupid.
Yeah.
Why would you do that? Why would you not just leave his death ambiguous?
I think everyone knew that he was going to come back in some form.
Yeah.
A lot of these movies like somehow stuff up trailers. I don't get it.
Yeah, I think it's the production studio as well. Like, oh, we need the meat of the like the best scene you have to go into like this 10-second trailer. Ends up being a spoiler.
Yeah.
Which I don't understand their theory. I don't understand their psyche behind it. But and one other, this is not a negative. It could be that the visuals I felt for Two Towers, like we have, obviously we're watching this film through rose-tinted glasses. We're reliving our childhoods, right? But when I was watching the CGI for a lot of like mocap stuff for Gollum, a lot of the CGI for like the units of like army units and that kind of stuff, some of it ages well. Some of it doesn't age nearly as well because the graphics were still, at that point, the whole mocap stuff for Gollum was still pioneering.
Very new, yeah.
They were pioneering the whole industry at that point.
Yeah.
They were doing something that was going to set the standards for the future mocap industry. There's some scenes that don't look as well as they could have, which is obviously, it's very difficult to make something like Gollum. They had to rotoscope out Andy Serkis manually every frame, replace it with CGI.
And we're going to watch a clip with Andy Serkis where they had to do that. So where he had to film it separately.
Yep.
Frodo and Sam were in this scene as well, and they had to film that separately.
Right, right.
And then the cameraman had to remember the movements that he did with Andy Serkis when he was acting it out. And then when they did combine the two scenes, he had to remember exactly what all the movements were and put it all together.
Yep.
So it's actually the last scene in the movie.
Oh, the last crawl.
It's the last scene in the movie, which we'll watch in spoilers. But I see what you mean. Because when I was watching Gollum this time, I'm like, you can tell he's not actually there.
Yeah. To be honest, there are some scenes where there's close-ups of Gollum's face. It looks amazingly photorealistic. Like the part where in the marshes and Frodo's asking, like, your name was Smeagol, right?
Yeah.
Like that scene was done amazingly well. And the CGI team, props to them. I don't know how they did it. There are some other scenes during daylight where you see Smeagol running through or like interacting with real world objects and it looks obviously CGI. So yeah, sometimes it's not as good, sometimes it's better. I feel like though when they showed Smeagol in Return of the King, the graphics got even better. So it's progression. Some things are better, some things are not.
Just watch the scene between Bilbo and Gollum in Desolation?
Desolation, yeah. I think it's the first one.
But it's flawless.
And then you realize
how far they've come.
Their ability to just show emotion and like make you feel so empathetic to Gollum there's a scene in the first book of The Hobbit where you're like, oh, fuck, this Gollum character is sneaky motherfucker. And then, and this is while Bilbo has a ring on. This is spoilers for The Hobbit.
The prequel of what we're watching now.
He puts on the ring and for a moment you're like, yes, finally, he's gotten over Gollum. And then it turns to Gollum and Gollum, he suddenly goes from, where the hell is the ring? I'm frustrated to, I'm now afraid.
And
the capture on that is unbelievable. And then you can see it on like the whole scene is about, because, you know, they reference this in the first movie, which is if it wasn't for Bilbo's kindness or whatever.
His pity.
Pity. And like that scene, but just look at the motion capture on that and you're like, oh my God, this is unbelievable.
Yep.
So you can definitely see how technology has developed to such an extent that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and in The Hobbit, you can actually see his skin. Like, it's got, like, texture.
It's got translucency. Yeah. So, it's as the light is shining, it's got this, like, it's so sallow. You can see it kind of bouncing in and around inside before it comes out.
It's
like they've gone next level. They did that for Two Towers as well. so they actually replicated real skin, but it took a lot of effort. They had to scrap the model multiple times, bring it back in. They eventually modeled it after Andy Serkis' face. That's when they found out it worked best, to actually match Andy Serkis' performance.
So before we jump into spoilers, any negatives, any other negatives?
Let's see. Oh, okay, yeah, there was one negative I had about... So this obviously, there's a lot of material in here that deviates from the source material. So in the final battle, for example, halfway through, some things deviate from the books. I feel like there were certain things that they left out of the books they could have incorporated more of, like just like more conversation on the talk of like Saruman's machinations, which they do show a lot of in here. But
what's that?
Saruman's machinations of like how he wants to like grow his own army. They show a lot of the industrialization of war.
That's true, actually. I think, yeah, this movie, I mean, look, I read the books when I was 11. I'm not even sure if I read them properly, to be honest, because I can't remember anything. I think they definitely do not go into Saruman's character or his intentions
in the theatrical editions. They don't even show him dying, technically.
Yeah. You skip over that,
yeah. In the book, he doesn't die.
No, so. He just walks.
He walks home.
He walks all the way to the Shire.
Yeah, he walks to the Shire. So, yeah. And, well, I mean, yeah. So, it's a real weird story. You should see what the actual story is in the books. It's so whack. It's honestly depressing.
Yeah.
The whole story. It's one of the most depressing stories I've ever heard of.
But full respect, like, I understand how difficult it was to fit stuff into this movie. So, I'm not surprised they didn't go more into it. But for that to be a negative, it's high praise.
Yeah. And Christopher Lee, on that topic, actually, Christopher Lee was not happy with Peter Jackson that he left out a lot of the Saruman stuff. And then he left him out completely out of the next movie in the theatrical edition. So, like, apparently he called him up to, like, show him Return of the King. And he sat down to watch it and he wasn't in the movie. And he's like, wait, where are my scenes in the movie?
Oh, it must be funny to see that.
But he managed to get him back for
Hobbit. Extended. So, and The Hobbit, which is really good because that was the last major thing he did.
But even in The Hobbit, they don't do... The things that they explore in The Hobbit when Saruman's there is also not according to the books properly, and it's actually, I think it's not even part of The Hobbit, part of the Silmarillion.
It's in the appendices for Lord of the Rings.
Whatever it is,
So there's like a small note saying the White Council flies to Dol
Guldur. Yeah, and it's not in the way it's portrayed. So even in The Hobbit, they kind of...
Well, it's stretching it out. It's not even portrayed, that's the thing.
Yeah, it's really pushing.
So we'll jump into spoilers now.
Yeah, so let's get into it.
If you haven't seen Two Towers... It's 20 years old. We highly recommend it.
Never watch it.
Watch it and then watch it again.
You could argue that if you watch Lord of the Rings, you're ruining your experience of every other movie because it's like this trilogy is too good.
Yeah.
So maybe don't watch it, you know. Protect yourself.
Or watch The Hobbit, then watch Rings of Power, then watch Hobbit, then watch Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
To build yourself up in the crescendo. Yeah. That's chronological order, technically.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Yeah, yes. Exactly.
Yeah. All right, we'll jump into spoilers. So go watch it, come back to this point, listen to our spoilers.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com.
Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Yep. So we'll start with a scene that I picked out. So we picked out that you actually alluded to the scene we talked about in the Fellowship episode where we talk about Bilbo's pity and how it...
Yeah.
So this time I picked a scene, which is the last scene in Two Towers, with Gollum. And
right after the so-called betrayal.
Yes. Right? Yeah. So let's see Andy Serkis's work.
I think everyone's worried at this point, right? Kind of going... So, like, everyone's worried. They're like, we've just gotten rid of... We had Smeagol only, got rid of Gollum, and now there's been this betrayal that's happened. Fuck, what's going to happen? Like, that, I think that's the fear in everyone's mind is that what has happened. And you're kind of actually really... You feel sorry for him.
Ends on a very ominous note, which we'll see. But the last dialogue in the movie is from Gollum.
Master looks after us. Master wouldn't hurt us.
Master broke his promise.
Don't ask Smeagol. Poor Smeagol.
Master betrayed us. Wicked, tricksy, false. We ought to wring his filthy little neck. Kill him. Kill him. Kill them both. And then we'll take the precious. And we'll be the master. But the fat hobbit, he knows. He's always watching. Then we stab them out. Put out his eyes and make him crawl. Yes, yes, yes. Kill them both. Yes, no, no. It's too risky, it's too risky.
Where's he going? Hey, Gollum, where are you? Smeagol?
We could let her do it. She could do it. Yes, precious, she could. And then we take it once they're dead. Once they're dead.
Come on, hobbits. Long ways to go yet. Smoother will show you the way. Follow me.
It ends with "Follow me."
Very ominous. Yeah. That like a very ominous ending, especially when like the fact that it's Smeagol is slowly waning out. Gollum's coming back. More dangerous part is Gollum's convincing Smeagol, "Oh, we can actually kill them."
And it's the first time in the movie because Smeagol kind of disagrees with Gollum throughout the movie and kind of pushes him away at one stage.
Yeah,
completely. Yeah. In this scene, you see him coming back, and you see him agreeing again.
Yeah,
and then he ends with, "We'll give them." Or give them to her.
Yeah. We'll let her.
Yeah.
And if people who are not familiar with the books, they don't know who is she.
Yeah. Who's this? Yeah.
But it's like, this is what I was alluding to. The books actually have, it ends with, Shelob. So,
Two Towers.
It's the Two Towers actually has Shelob in the Two Towers. So people watching this would have been like, oh crap. They didn't show her, but they're alluding to it.
Yes.
Which is really crazy because, Shelob is one of those characters where it's like, it's not good. It's not good for Sam and Frodo.
Yeah. Because Shelob's like an ancient, it's like this entity that's been there for a long time. Before.
Daughter of Ungoliant. So we're talking about the direct offspring off of one of these mythical creatures that, is in the Silmarillion.
Yeah. And that's why they call it Kirith Ungol. Isn't that
Ungol. Yeah. Yeah. Ungoliant.
Because that's the path that goes past. Her, right?
Yeah. Ungol is a species, I think, is the actual name of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
On that scene that we just watched, so it's a 2-minute scene, continuous shot, so it's all continuously.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, there's no cuts. Due to the complexity of the 2-minute shot, it was the last one that they finished for this movie. It involved Andy Serkis acting out the full scene, after which the camera operator had to reshoot its background without Serkis, memorizing the camera movements he had previously made. Serkis later had to reenact the scene on a green screen set in the studio. They recorded his performance, incorporated into the Gollum animation, which, of course, had to be seamlessly blended into the background. So a lot of work had to go just for one shot.
Yeah. And that's not even the most complex shots. The most complex ones is when Gollum is fighting or holding on to like Sam or Frodo, then they have to actually like take out Andy Serkis, put in the CGI. But the complexity of that shot is lost on a lot of viewers. It's a really good shot.
And I think because it's an animated character, I think people miss the fact that Andy Serkis is actually acting this out.
He is. There is also a dedicated team of animators who do a lot of the facial movements. So they didn't use the facial beads. Mm. They didn't have that in this.
Yeah.
They'd literally have a little camera, like a TV showing Andy Serkis's face. And if he grimaced, the animators would try manually move the muscles down.
Yeah.
Whereas they've actually made that process a bit more automated in the more recent stuff. Because they actually have facial beads and like the reference points that the computer looks at and will change the face. But that was all manually done. So all the facial expressions that you see in Two Towers are actually manually animated. And they're done by a really dedicated team of like animators. They followed Andy Serkis' performance though.
Yes.
So that's having him there was like a world of difference.
Yeah, and that's why I think talk of Oscars for motion capture acting came up when he did Planet of the Apes, because he's the main character in Planet of the Apes.
Right.
Obviously, he wasn't even nominated, but people like he's giving a really good performance.
Yeah.
If he wasn't an animated character and he just did that as himself, he probably would be nominated. But well,
was the category of motion capture even there during 2002? No. I didn't think so. I would say it opened up due to these films.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're telling me he would have won even more Oscars than he would have won? Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. 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 If it was a category, he would have definitely got it.
Wait, can you pass me my Pepsi?
Your elven, your orc drink, orc draft. You know what? The orcs pour down Mary's throat in the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah. What is that?
It's apparently SodaStream Pepsi concentrate.
Oh, wow.
I'm not even kidding. There's a scene where.
I didn't know Tolkien knew about that.
Tolkien? Yeah, he knew about Pepsi concentrate and SodaStream. Off draft. That's going back to the beginning of the film.
So I think the way we'll split up this section is we'll talk about each of the. I've got four categories here, but then Gandalf kind of comes into one of them.
Okay.
Sam and Frodo.
Yeah.
Aragorn, Legolas, Gimli.
Yeah.
Gandalf. Parallel storyline with a couple of other storylines, and then Pippin and Merry is their one.
Yep.
So we could start with, since we just watched this, Sam and Frodo.
Yeah.
Like I said, that not that much actually happens in their storyline in this movie. It's more around Gollum. Firstly, they get Gollum on their side under Sméagol. You know when Frodo betrays Gollum?
Yeah.
It's not, that wasn't his intention, right? But in the movie, it feels like he's kind of like intentionally, you know, he's like, come, follow me. When he's in that pond?
Yeah. When he's in that, where the Rangers of Ithilien
and Faramir's
got their little forest, right?
Yeah.
Well, he's doing it to save his life.
Yeah.
That's what Sméagol doesn't know. He doesn't know there's arrows pointed at him about to kill him. So Frodo's being obviously a little bit more manipulative and nice. Like, oh, come Sméagol. Good Sméagol. That's it. Like, he's coaxing him like a dog with a toy, which is exactly what Andy Serkis is trying to show. He's got a fish in his mouth. It looks really, especially when Sméagol knows what's up when he gets caught. And he's like telling Master, please protect me. And then that's when you see Frodo coming out and say, no, don't struggle. Yeah, it's okay. Just listen to me. And he feels guilty already.
Yeah.
I think he feels guilty from the get-go of saying, I kind of convinced him to come out so he can be captured by these guys. But they would have killed you. So I think it's the hero's dilemma. It's like he's trying to do it to save his life.
But that's basically what breaks him in the end. Even though Sam also tells him afterwards that he didn't mean to do that. Just before they leave
Osgiliath. He didn't mean to. But you can tell at that point, even he's like,
it was too
Smeagol's like, he already doesn't trust Sam.
Yeah.
And I think the last thread was Frodo. He might have this kind of relationship, but it's kind of gone up to that point.
Yes.
I don't think it's a fault of Frodo. I just think it's the tragedy of Sméagol.
Yes.
But I think it's also a tragedy about how the kingdom of men deal with, as in like, if they're all just threatening Sméagol, right? They don't know what this creature is, but they're like, we're just going to kill this. We're going to kill this thing, right? There's no, it was in a pond just singing its song, just like happily doing nothing to interfere, right? And they were like, I'm going to kill this being unless you, at least we want to capture this being. I think it kind of also talks about the evil of man, right?
True. It shows like they consider this a gangle creature, an ugly creature, but I think the way they treat it shows the darkness in their own hearts.
Yeah, exactly. No empathy whatsoever. And they essentially, it's like, you're creating this monster. They essentially, because like there are definitely other ways to approach this situation, and that just did not even cross their mind. They're just like, what is this disgusting thing?
Yeah. Yeah. Also, the song that he sings in the pond is pretty good.
Oh, yeah, the rock and pearl.
Yeah,
sweet.
The rock and pearl is not a sun curl. Yeah, that one.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. You should do the whole thing.
No. Let's scare off every podcast.
So juicy, sweet. That's great.
And that little scene was done.
Wait, can you sing it and make that the intro to this podcast? Get rid of that music.
To catch a fish, so juicy, sweet.
Yeah, there we go.
Make it the intro.
So good.
Do not cut that into a TikTok reel.
That'll be so good.
That'll be hilarious.
Oh, man.
But that was also motion capture, that little scene where that was fully done in the back. I watched it behind the scenes. He does the whole thing. Even the little, like, fish slipping out.
Yeah.
Like, he plays the whole thing.
That scene is like, crazy, right? Because it's, like, that scene is amazing. It's, like, very beautifully made, right? Because in the moonlight, it's in this, like, area. This area looks, it's kind of magical, right?
Yep, yep.
But everything about it's sinister. It's, like, Faramir and his men.
It looks like that painting, actually, in the back. Yeah. I'm not even kidding. Yeah, it looks like that.
Exactly. And it's, like...
There's a painting in our room where it's, like, a nice little... landscape of like the full moon setting across some mountains at nighttime. It's exactly what this scene is depicting
Phillips.
I'll put the picture up on Instagram. So
yeah, it's what pretty cool. And it's a waterfall there as well.
Yeah.
Well, it's like such a contrast to the scenery, is such a contrast to actually the truth of the situation, right? Like it's such an innocent thing that's happening. This being is just chilling out, singing that song that Basket just covered. Like there's nothing terrible going on, but then you realize that if Frodo wasn't going to save the life of this being, like these guys were just going to cold-bloodedly just murder it.
I think they weren't going to actually kill it. They were trying to do it.
Yeah, but then when they beat the shit out of Gollum, it's not like, oh, we're just doing this so we can threaten. They beat the shit out of Smeagol. Savage.
But why? So I think the reason why is Faramir is looking for the answer. Why is this creature leading these hobbits on a journey? This is not right. Where are they going? And it's like it leads into the whole thing about their weakness to the ring.
Yeah.
And when he finds out that they're carrying something that is like the One Ring, which is what his brother was sent to do, it gets dark because that's exactly what he wants to fulfill the dream of his father. So then you get to know Faramir as a character, as a captain, and his weakness. That the whole thing plays into it.
Yeah.
So it's like, only in the extended edition do you really get that.
Yeah.
Do you really?
Understand? But you see it in theatrical as well, but you don't realize the full weight of it unless you watch
the. Because you don't. In the extended edition shows the victory.
Yes. With Boromir and
Osgiliath.
Yeah. Prior to the meeting of the Council of Elrond. Yeah. Which is an amazing. I don't know. This is the one scene they shouldn't have cut out of the theatrical edition where Sean Bean comes back. The last flashback between brothers, and it's a beautiful
moment. And you don't actually see their father till Return of the King in the theatricals, right?
Oh, yeah. You don't see Denethor at all.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
No. Nah.
Yeah.
So in this one, they actually show Denethor in the flashback where Faramir is saying, like, is celebrating with Boromir. It's a wonderful celebration. They won a small, you know, battle in Osgiliath, and it's a beautiful moment for Boromir as well, showing his true motivations. Like his father essentially just says, "There's a meeting. We should be the ones because it's our blood being spilt. We need to get that ring back to Gondor. So go bring me back this mighty gift." And Boromir is like, "I don't want to go." And Faramir is like, "Oh, if he doesn't want to go, send me in instead." And Denethor's like, "Oh, yeah, you'd like that, wouldn't you? Faramir, captain of Gondor, wants to show his true quality. No, my firstborn's going, you shut up." And it's just like, he goes and he dies. And it's like, it brings this line back to a really tragic exchange where Faramir goes back to Denethor in Minas Tirith. And then he finally asks him, "What you prefer? It was I who went, and I was the one who died, and he was the one who lived."
He just says yes.
And he's like, "Yeah, I wish that."
Piece of shit.
Yeah. It's like, oh, it's so brutal, man.
It's so bad.
And even in this, when, because obviously he knows that Boromir has died, but Frodo doesn't yet.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. It's connecting
back to this. So this is the first time that, do they know that he saved them? They do, right?
Frodo and Sam?
Yeah.
No. Because they leave before the Battle of Amon Hand finishes.
But they.
So they don't actually know what happens to Merry and Pippin. They don't know what happens to Boromir.
Oh, he saves Merry and Pippin, doesn't he?
Boromir saves Merry and Pippin.
Yeah.
So Merry and Pippin both know.
Yeah.
It's actually Pippin who knows when he's confronted with that. He comes out and tells Denethor, "Oh, he died saving us."
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the Return of the King.
That's Return of the King. Yeah. Right.
They pledge his service to that.
Yeah.
And then Gandalf's like, "God damn it. I told this guy to shut up."
that's a wonderful dynamic. But so the Two Towers sets up so many different like arcs. Faramir's arc is arguably one of the best ones. And it's that moment is really interesting when they're in the cave and he's just reminiscing about Boromir.
Also, that point when they're about to get captured, that's the first time you realize, or at least in the movie, that Sauron is accumulating men as part of his force. Because all this time you're talking about there's orcs being mobilized.
Yeah.
You don't realize there's people on Oliphants and they're actually men. There's men that are joining him. I think that's the first time you see them.
So even before that scene when you're talking about the scene where they're in the forest and they see the Haradrim walking through the forest with like big Oliphants and the archers. Oh, it's
Haradrim. Yeah.
Even before then, before they come through the forest of Ithilien, they come to, you know how Sméagol leads them to the Black Gate?
Yes.
Right up to the front of the Black Gate, and they're about to go through it. And then there's these men of the East.
Doesn't that happen after?
No, it's before. Sméagol leads them right to the front of the Black Gate.
Yeah.
And then they're like, oh, the Black Gate, we finally reached it. And then they don't know how to get in. And then this like army of like Easterlings or men of Rune. Rune means East, so translator's note, men of East. They basically come marching in, which is an awesome scene where they come in. They have their own like march and like their horns and they open the gate up and Sméagol's losing it because he's like getting PTSD from all his, who knows what he's experienced, right?
Yeah.
In his travels. The gate opens up. They want to go, but then Sméagol pulls them back in the last minute. It's like,
yeah.
It's like, don't go because like, they'll catch you and you're going through the front. You're not going to make it. He has to convince Sam and Frodo saying there's another way. We have to go around the south side and go through the border. There's a stairs and a tunnel and whatnot.
And then they go
through Ithilien. No, south. So north,
So
they came from the north, from Imin Muil. They passed the front of the Black Gate.
That's right.
And eventually Frodo agrees, okay, he's led us this far, let's follow him further.
Yeah.
Then they go to the Ithilien.
That's
right. So when he gets captured by Faramir, they're kind of going down to the south, which is where like the rangers were monitoring. So it's the geology is really interesting. The maps and
locations. So I go on this website called Lord of the Ring Maps, and then it will just highlight, you can tick whatever box you want, but it just shows you the path of every character. And so that's how things make more sense. I remember when I was watching this and even when I was watching all these videos on YouTube just about things in general and rings and, you know, rings of power, just having that map in front of you makes things just make sense.
Yep.
You understand the bearing there, everything. Also, I find it really interesting that in this, a lot of people talk about in maybe other writings, the East is like this unknown, more hopeful land. But in this, it's straight up, the East is evil.
Not necessarily evil. The East is filled with people, some of which are loyal to Sauron.
Yeah.
So these Easterlings, or these Ravanian men, and in the making of, they were trying to depict men who were very wealthy and rich, who received a lot of, like, they could deck out their armor in full, like, you know, embellished armor. But they had a slightly Saracen culture that they could actually develop separate from Gondor and separate from, like, you know, the West.
Yeah.
So they had their own culture. And you could see that in their design. They looked very Saracen-like, like almost Middle Eastern. But they were very careful. They didn't want the design team to replicate any existing culture of humanity because they didn't want to represent any modern peoples. It was really effective, though. It looks scary as hell.
Yeah.
But they also look extremely unique. That's what I was talking about, the multiple expansions of cultures. This is one culture. The Haradrim is a complete separate culture. They come from the south. And then you have all these factions of like Mordor orcs, Mordor Uruk-hai, separate from the Isengard Uruk-hai. There's like four separate factions in Mordor alone right now. So it's like they're amassing all kinds of forces. And that Two Towers does a great job in building that tension up of like Mordor's building up their armies. It's not just orcs. It's men. It's like Easterlings, it's Southrons, it's Haradrim. It's like crazy amounts of people.
And in that scene in front of the Black Gate, that's when they disguise themselves as a rock.
Yeah.
Yeah, they use their cape.
Yeah.
And the cape was given to them by the
elves? Lothlorien elves.
Yeah.
Or Rivendell elves. I can't remember who actually gives them
probably
the cape.
Rivendell, I reckon.
I think Rivendell. Really? Yeah, I think they got it in Rivendell. And these are meant to disguise you wherever you are, like nature-wise. So if you're in forest.
This is the first time you properly see it.
Yeah. It was good. That was a cool depiction.
Also, like the whole Men of the East, there's a really good YouTube channel that talks about this lore, and it's called Men of the West.
Oh, wow.
As a reference to like, you know, Aragorn's last call before at the Black Gate when he's like launching the full, this post Mouth of Sauron.
Oh, yeah.
Beheading in extended edition. And he's like, and then he gathers them and he's like, Men of the West. And I'm like, oh yeah, okay. Now I finally understand what this, why this YouTube channel is called Men of the West. I like never understood, but I'm like, ah.
Oh, you thought it was
Men of the
like,
West
yeah,
are the good ones, and the Men of the East are like the corruptible semi-joined.
That's the way they've put the factions in, yeah, which is kind of, it's kind of controversial, but.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, it makes sense, right? I mean,
was maybe like the Numenorean and the faithful versus like the people who
exactly the kings
went against, went sided with Morgoth and now Sauron.
Yeah.
So yeah, it kind of makes, you see that in Rings of Power now as well. So yeah, Sam and Frodo's arc is a very interesting one, and it, and the ending of it where they end up in Osgiliath again is quite cathartic but tragic as well, because you see the toll it takes on Frodo. The journey. This is what essentially where Frodo's journey in Two Towers is. You see the toll that it takes on him, and it's quite devastating.
And you don't yet see, I mean, there starts to be a bit of a divide between Sam and Frodo in this, but not, you see it much more in Return of the King when they actually do split up completely. Anything else on Sam and Frodo? So they're kind of on that journey. There is a part where they go through some, is it like swamplands?
The Dead Marshes?
Yeah. That part was interesting visually.
Visually very interesting. Very, very interesting.
That's where the ominous. That's where the war takes place, right?
The old war. Yeah. The battle at the Dagorlad Plains.
Yeah. It's
essentially the old battlefield.
Of the
First Alliance. Yeah. Of Last Alliance of Men and Elves. Yeah. So you see all the dead bodies there. Really ominous setting. Yeah, because it's, and I feel like in the books, this was inspired off of Tolkien's memory of like trench warfare.
Oh, 100%.
Oh, he's got to be his memory.
Because there's like, Dead Man's Land and all that stuff, yeah.
But there's experiences of him showing like how dead bodies would just rot in the mud and it would just, they wouldn't decompose.
Yeah.
It would just be like there. And I feel like his memories are seared into that story. It manifests in all kinds of ways. So this is one of those more ominous, very macabre settings.
Yeah.
It's really cool. It's really cool to see their characters.
And then the Nazgul come out and they like take refuge under like this lone tree or wherever, or rock or whatever they're under.
Yeah.
That's all these scenes where it's just like these plains of like death, and then there's just the Nazgul at the top and the fell beast just like riding, and you're just like,
oh man.
And Smeagol's losing his mind.
Yes.
He's like,
rates. Rates on wheels.
Yeah, it's nuts.
Next to like rates on wheels, and it's just like,
and also you realize how much bloody Smeagol has seen.
Yeah,
Smeagol's seen everything.
Oh, he's seen a lot of shit. He's seen some shit, man.
That's crazy. He's seen everything and somehow still made it out. Like,
yeah.
Well, he survived, and like you know, you see that in the beginning of Return of the King, like what he went through. It's not good, but he's seen some stuff, man. That's Sam and Frodo's journey in a nutshell.
So, Aragorn, Legolas, Gimli. So, this is one that I find really interesting, maybe because I find
Aragorn's... I think it's pretty... you can't debate the fact that this is the most interesting storyline.
Yes, yeah. I agree.
This is where all the action's at. This is it.
And Aragorn's arc, overall arc. I think in this one, you start feeling like maybe he thinks he can become king. Because in the first one, he's I don't think he has that idea. I think in this one, after Helm's Deep, or even before that, I think he starts sensing that maybe he can become the king.
But I think, well, I'm not sure about the books, but at least in the movies, I don't think there's necessarily an intent to become king. It's, we need to do something to fulfill this mission / we need to deal with the problems that we're facing. Often that's often what, I think Gandalf knows. Gandalf has a greater, he knows more about what's going on, right? But I think often with this trio, it's like, how do we deal with these problems?
Mm.
And it just happens to be one of the strategies that can be used is you can unite these kingdoms and you get the, you know, the people of Rohan, and you unite these men who are under the stewardship in Gondor. And like, therefore, ultimately, if you lead them and then you already are the heir, then you'll become king. But it never was primarily about being king, which is a good part.
Yeah,
right.
It wasn't about becoming king.
Yeah, it's not like, oh, we need some king, or we need an old king of Gondor, whatever. It's about, we're getting fucked by the orcs. Everyone's being destroyed. Let's solve this problem. And more that men distrust each other, and you have this person that can come and unite people. And
Well, not just unite men, but his friendship with the elves as well, and now the dwarves as well. So it's everyone.
Yeah. It's like, that's not just the fact that this one guy has such good relationships with elves and dwarves and different like kings is now being seen as a thing. Oh shit, we might actually need this. Like this, you get the first sense of it in Two Towers. Like, we might need this because we don't know how overpowered we are right now by the enemy. This is the first time you get the feel for the numbers against us are so overwhelming. We can't just go in it like, oh, okay, this country defends their own lands. God no defends their own borders. It'll be fine. No, it's like we need something else. And that's when you get the first hint of it.
There's some great visual foreshadowing of this. So when he first rides into Rohan.
Yeah, when the
flag. And the flag breaks and it lands in front of him.
Oh, on Edoras.
Yeah, he sees,
he's riding up, he sees it fall. Yeah. And then the music starts, the theme of Rohan, you're like, oh, this is unbelievable.
Unbelievable theme. Yeah. There's a lot of amazing foreshadowing shots in this.
Yeah.
Even Gondor's theme, the first time we hear Gondor's theme is in Two Towers. It's in the flashback with Boromir. We were just talking about it. When Boromir is about to go and he looks up at the flag of Gondor, that is the first time you hear Howard Shore's theme of Gondor. And you start to feel the culture of Gondor and the theme of it. Same thing with Rohan. You see the first time you hear the theme of Rohan is when they're actually on the chase. They finally go up on the rock and they look over the horizon. It's like, oh, land of Rohan, home of the horse lords.
Yeah, yeah.
It's this beautiful open wide scenery of Alexandria and South Island of New Zealand. Oh, yeah, the scenery in Two Towers is one of the best. The actual live landscapes and the rolling hills and the wild plains. It's amazing what they did with the locations they found. And Edoras, like Rohan's capital, I think it's got to be the most magical movie setting in the world because most of what you see about Edoras is built. They actually built a township on that hill. It's called Mount Sunday in Canterbury. And the way they found it was an absolute magical fluke. It was like the helicopter tour guide was flying around and he's a scout. He finds this little mountain and it's surrounded by these snow-capped. It's technically a mountain surrounded by snow-capped mountains.
Also the foreshadowing scene. As that happens, the start of that scene is when Eowyn is so sick of everything. She kind of runs out of the main king's hut, tower, whatever the fuck it is. Yeah. And she's lost all hope and she's in this she's always wearing white. And then she just sees the flag fly off. And then Aragorn just comes up and it's oh, this is so good. This is unreal.
Yeah. Because they're rocking up to a country that's basically at rock bottom.
Yeah, exactly. I think Gimli says something around you see more cheer in a graveyard or something that.
Yeah. It's true because it's the king is under this weird spell. Trance, he's gone. The prince is dead. King's son is dead after being ambushed by orcs. The Eomer has been banished because he tried to tell Wormtongue, who's the right hand of Theoden.
And the Rohirrim have pissed off as well with him.
They went with him.
They just go around.
Yeah. Which is an interesting scene. The fact that Wormtongue can so easily manipulate everyone. And he tries to even tell Eowyn, your hopelessness here is just going to keep festering. Mm. You know, I can give you what you want. I can give you security and that kind of. He tries to actually woo her. But she's your words are poison. That's where she goes out. And Eowyn, the character of Eowyn, by the way, I just got to say, Miranda Otto's depiction of Eowyn, amazing. Amazing depiction. It's a very complex character to do. And she's one of my favorite characters in the whole series because of the fact that her arc is so incredible. The way she starts off in Two Towers as being this shield maiden who wants to fight, but at every turn is told by the men in her family, no, you can't fight. Stay with the women and the children in the caves. Or take the women and children and lead them to safety. And she's just I want to fight.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's just I want to take a sword.
MCU needs to take note some of how to create a strong female character. Exactly. And that's the thing. Is that,
here we go.
No, it's when you have... And
there's a TikTok coming up, right?
you actually have a strong female character who you know is, even despite the fact, because, at some point in this movie, she's interested in Aragorn, and then she realizes he has his own love interest, and then she realizes this guy's 90 years old at the same time.
Yeah. Which is actually an extended scene as well.
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah, it's not a movie,
But, that's the thing, is that, you have this person who hasn't had this, amazing run, dealing with their own issues and always getting shot down and stuff, and then eventually has their moment, but also throughout shows moments of strength and it's moments of strength in their own natural way. That's how you actually write a strong female lead. That's what it is. It's not just, I'm going to make someone invincible with no arc whatsoever. So it's awesome. And kind of moments of vulnerability throughout, she's the one that wants to stick with her uncle, but is just hopeless. And that's when this scene that we're talking about when the flag falls down
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But before that, let me just say, the is it the first scene, which is that meme scene where we're talking about elven sight or foresight? Where, it's in Two Towers, right? When
it's before this, and he talks
about the sun.
It's a red sun. Rises. Yeah.
Yeah.
Blood has been spilled.
It's like, what the fuck are you talking about? You on shrooms? What the fuck is this?
Yeah, this is when they're chasing Merry and Pippin and they're on the fields.
It's like, I think the movie is good at showing that he's special in this way, but they should have done a little bit more to say what that means. Because like, he's like, motherfucker, you're telling me that the sun just rises and looks a bit more
on
red?
On a cursory skin level thing, it's like the elves, the Sindarin elves especially, like the ones who are in the forest and the nature, are very attuned to the natural world.
Yeah.
To the point where...
Well, I think that's what they should have done is like do a bit more of that and like actually show kind of how he feels it, not just turn around.
Well, it's kind of like that whole scene where Aragorn's like, some strange evil is at work here. Like the land sets its will against us, almost gives strength to the Uruk-hai so they're going faster. So Legolas is the one who actually says that line.
Mm.
And he's the one who's like, you know, the Uruks have turned northeast. They're taking the hobbits to Isengard using his elven sight. He's so in tune to nature, and I feel like it's a reference, maybe, the way Tolkien was writing Sindarin elves was that they are interpreting the light of the Valar in every step of the way. So, like, the red sun is maybe talking about a like the representation of the light of the two trees that is more somber than sad or something, because they exist.
And I think they're also feeling, because Isengard is also part of the – it's like the south of that plain that – because all this is coming from Isengard, right? Like all the orcs and stuff like that. So, which if you look at the map, it's kind of like the plains of Rohan kind of come down, and then Isengard and the Forest of Fangorn. So I think also they're kind of, when they know about that land, I don't know who says that. I think it is Aragorn that says.
Yeah, Aragorn says it in the films.
Yeah. They might also be like sensing that, because Aragorn is supposed to have his own little, kind of, Numenoreans have their own.
Oh, yeah.
They don't properly allude to it in this, but. He also has his own kind of interpretations of the world, and can sense, has his stronger sense of what's going on.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I find the start of these three, like Gimli, Legolas, and Aragorn, is sick, because you see, because you know that Merry and Pippin are being carried away or whatever. You know about this story, and they're just getting butt fucked by these Uruk-hai, essentially. Not literally. Okay? That's not what happens. But the funny thing is, like, it's actually frightening to watch. There's this group of Uruk-hai and orcs and whatever, just taking these hobbits casually, and they're a terrifying bunch. And then these three are like, let's hunt these motherfuckers down. And they start just tearing after them.
Yeah.
Which is running after them. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, holy shit. These guys mean business. Like, they're just not, there's like no chill for these guys. They're hunting these guys down.
Yeah.
And,
it's a cool sequence. It's Peter Jackson's favorite sequence that he shot in the movie, that chase sequence.
It's Dunedin, right? They filmed this all in.
Oh, they filmed it in Alexandria, Canterbury, south, like Twizel as well, like near southeast of the South Island.
Yeah.
Dunedin's a bit too far south, but it's basically everything between Dunedin and Christchurch, which is a really big expanse. But most, there's
Twizel. Also, Dunedin also sounds like the Dunedain.
Dunedain. Oh, that is true. That is true.
Which is always, I found interesting. Did they name this? Anyway.
Yeah. It's that whole sequence, I think, is the fastest pace in the movie, where they're chasing him down. It's near the beginning as well, so it's quite intense. And then we switch over to Merry and Pippin intermittently between Aragorn, Legolas, and Gimli, which constantly keeps the tension going, because you're like, these are hobbits that they're being taken hostage, but they're not doing well. Merry's got a gash on his forehead. Pippin's trying to take care of Merry, and
it's different timelines, because they're discovering, they kind of just, it's like the play on the mind again. It's like, oh, they're dead, but they think that the hobbits are dead.
Yeah.
And then you find out what happens to them, and then these guys actually find out they're not actually dead. Like, it's like a flip. They keep going back and forth.
That's when they come across Eomer's group.
Yeah.
And then he's like, we've been hunting a pack of Uruk-hai going westward across the plain.
None were spared. We burned them all.
Yeah, that's really worrying. And then there's a lot of stake in the audience, because the last time we see Merry and Pippin is like a big horse is about to smash Pippin's head.
Pippin.
You don't see him again. Then Eomer's like, you know, we slaughtered the Uruks. We left none alive. Then the dread kind of sets in.
Yeah.
And
then we get to the scene where Aragorn kicks the.
Yeah, they get to the mound of Uruk-hai, and it's that famous scene of Gimli finding one of the belts, Elven belts. And
that's right. Yeah.
Viggo Mortensen does this amazing take of like just kicking a helmet and screaming in rage. And what you don't know.
Don't say it.
I have to say it. This is the podcast. This is the podcast. So anyone who doesn't know, that was the fifth take of him kicking the helmet. First three takes was all over the place. He was kicking the helmet. And then Peter Jackson was like, I'm putting the camera here to try and kick the helmet across. Second take, it was getting closer. Third take, it got really close. Like it almost flew over. Fourth take, beautiful kick, went right over the camera. And so Peter Jackson's like, if the fourth take was this good, fifth take would be the best. So he told Viggo, one more take. He kicks it and he has this like blood-curdling scream and frustration. He sits down and Peter's like, oh, this is amazing.
This is so really good. Put his heart into it.
Really put his heart into it. And then Viggo's doing this, you know, just he's still in character. They cut. And apparently after that, Viggo just came by and told Peter Jackson, I've broken my toe. And he channeled that pain. And it's just like, I was one of the first people when I first saw this behind the scenes, I was going around my school in high school going, oh, did you know that Viggo Mortensen broke his toe? See, I was one of those guys. Now it's a meme. It's like people who like can't resist saying that shit.
He gets absolutely owned in this trilogy of movies. Have you heard about, so there's, I don't know whether it's Return of the King or in the Helm's Deep scene where a shield or something goes into him and he, like his front tooth, like half of it comes out.
Helm's Deep.
And then he was like, nah, let's just continue. And everyone was like, fuck off. And they flew him to like civilization for just like emergency dental work.
Yeah.
And then got him back. Yep. He was like, nah, fuck it, it'll be fine. And so there's videos of him showing his teeth
broken
and stuff. Yeah.
This was so that we're kind of jumping towards the end of these three character storyline, but the Helm's Deep shots.
Yeah.
Were night shots. They had to be done at night. It was 3 to 4 months of continuous night shots.
Yeah.
So like they had to go from like, I don't know, 7 p.m. to like 3 a.m. every night for 3 to 4 months. By the end of that, Viggo.
In the summer as well, right? Because film in the winter.
Yeah.
And in New Zealand, but this was in summer. There's not that much nightfall in summer in New Zealand.
That is true.
It makes it even harder.
Yeah. The Helm's Deep stuff was shot in Wellington because they had to use a quarry. Right. To film that stuff in. But even then, like by the time the shot was finished, Viggo had like chunks out of his hand due to stunt work and the swords ripping off tooth. Yeah, like that. There was a lot of the stuntmen had all kinds of injuries.
Yeah.
Because they were filming in wet weather, metal. And it's an amazing story of endurance for those guys. I don't know how they did it.
Yeah. Well, the Battle of Helm's Deep, it was shot over 4 months.
4 months, yeah.
Four months.
Constant night shots.
And they had the rain machine for the whole time period. So every day they were using the rain machine.
Yeah. It's insane because these Urukai, the guy who did the stuntmen who did the Urukai, they're actually really buff. A lot of them Maori, a lot of them like, you know, South Islanders. And they had to wear these prosthetic suits day in, day out. It was drenched. And they didn't have dryers, like enough dryers for everyone. So they went through hell. Yeah, they went through actual trench warfare.
The thing is that the reason why the orcs are so fierce, like they're so scary looking in Lord of the Rings as opposed to the Hobbit, is because they actually have, like, there is no CGI in this for the
point.
Orcs.
Good it's point. It's actual all prosthetics, costume. Facial prosthetics as well. And they're so menacing. Like that opening scene with the Urukai, when you see facial prosthetics and it's like, you know, the guy's like, Saruman will have his prize. We will deliver it. It's like, you can see his face move.
I still don't even understand
how
they.
So good.
They make the mouths look mental, right? Like all these screwed up teeth, and I still don't understand how they do this dental prosthesis. Like, I don't get it.
Yeah.
Like, someone needs to explain it to me.
It's magic. It's like they apply it on the top of it and underneath, and it's like,
yeah, it's crazy.
It's so crazy, and obviously the actors who are speaking have to be like voiceover dubbed afterwards.
Yeah,
but it still looks so much more menacing.
Still looks
than any CGI could ever achieve.
Exactly.
Like that scene where Merry and Pippin are in the forest, and the Uruks are hungry, and they're like, "Oh, I'm starving. We've had nothing but bread," and they look at the hobbits,
meat's
and it's
stuck
like
on the menu, boys.
Yeah, it's like why can't we eat their legs? They don't need them. It's just so menacing. And that one orc wears like sallow face, and he's the one who eventually chases Merry and Pippin. It's nightmare inducing. It is no CGI. It's all prosthetics. And then
that's why all persistent. These movies that don't use CGI. So like the original Jurassic Park, where they just use the actual T-Rex head and moving eyeballs. This stuff looks unbelievably real, and it holds up. It stands the age of time, like that Jurassic Park. Still a classic. You watch it again, you're not like, oh, this aged poorly. It ages very well. And same with Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
It ages so well.
They use a lot of actual prosthetics. Shout out to Jed Brophy, who was the orc in Two Towers.
Every character ever.
Yeah. Oh, he was two orcs in Two Towers. The one who's like, why can't we have some meat? And he eventually tries to kill the hobbits and he gets his head chopped off. Uruks eat him up. He's later in The Hobbit as Nori, I believe. And then he comes back in Rings of Power as another orc. So he's the one recurring thread between all the franchises.
He's friends with Nerd of the Rings.
Is he really?
Yeah, and that's how he gets all his info.
Oh, shit. I didn't know that.
Info about the show and stuff. Yeah.
Oh, cool. Shout out to Nerd of the Rings. Yeah, check him out. He's really cool.
Only reason I know things about the actual lore is because of that channel. And Men of the West.
And Men of the West. It's
Men of the West.
Nice.
Just on that, on the prosthetic stuff, the level of detail that they had. So they didn't want the orcs' mouths to look pink like normal humans. So they made the meat licorice, so it looked black.
Wow. Okay, there you go. Oh,
there you go. I'm just like, how do they do this? It's so black. Oh my
God. So that's crazy. Munching on licorice, detail. So it looks like they're...
Oh, so, yeah, because their mouths are like always dirty all the time. So I'm like, oh, there you go. They're always munching on licorice. There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's disgusting. But
yeah. It's ominous. Yeah. It's
I mean, really cool. Licorice, actually. I wouldn't mind some right now. Real licorice.
Yeah.
No, I don't.
Such a, always a disappointing podcast. Huh?
Okay, anything else on Aragorn, Legolas, Gimli?
Well, without going into Helm's Deep, like the end, we can talk about the final battle.
The counting
battle.
Game?
The counting
game. This is when it starts, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In Helm's Deep.
Legolas and Gimli.
Yeah, in Helm's Deep, yeah.
Legolas and Gimli's dynamic in this is really good. It's really good. I enjoyed it.
There's a part in Helm's Deep where, like, do you want me to narrate it to you or do you want me to get you a box where he can't see?
He can't see beyond the ramparts.
Yeah, but this, is where, this is when all the memes. Have you seen the... There is a YouTube channel that is just about memes, and they just cut and they edit Lord of the Rings scenes of Gimli so like so well, but so that he just seems like the creepiest fuck. But in this scene where he tells him like, hey, "Do you want me to narrate to you or get you a box?" and then Gimli just turns around and just starts. That's all it is. It's just this creepy that's his reaction, laugh.
Yeah. Oh, that's brilliant.
And then that is like the meme for Gimli, and like. You could like make any like it's just like it was this meme where like people it's like say the, things it's, that could be dodgy. And
yeah, then yeah. It's just like that's brilliant. So shout out to John Rhys-Davies, man, with the double act. He voiced Treebeard along with he did Gimli as well. So
did he?
He voiced Treebeard. Yeah.
Okay.
So good. Yeah. So good. Gimli's a badass in this. You know.
Yeah.
When
he's good.
Aragorn. Chucks him. Tells it. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like throw me. Yeah. Chuck me.
Now, those three have some great stuff in that Helm's Deep sequence because, Legolas and Gimli have that, and then Aragorn and Gimli have that.
Aragorn and Gimli is basically the glue that holds these guys together.
Yeah.
He's so cool. And you see, he's a proper battle tank. He likes battle, and he's like, that Helm's Deep sequence is very frightening because you see this ominous force coming in. Gimli's just like, send them to me. Come on. And he's just like,
I'm pretty sure his count is like higher than Legolas in this battle.
Yeah, he wins.
And then Legolas takes it with the next one, but like,
yeah, yeah.
But yeah, this one's nuts.
He actually gets him. Which is really cool.
Absolute tank.
And he's not just, like, I know a lot of people think that the movie's kind of butchered Gimli's character by making him comic relief. He is comic relief, but also Merry and Pippin are comic relief. Aragorn is comic relief in some scenes, you know? Like, it doesn't necessarily, he's not putting down one character. There's a lot of cool scenes with John Rhys-Davies, where especially when, like, Theoden comes to Helm's Deep and he's like, oh, we'll be fine, we'll protect ourselves. And Gimli's just like, this is no common mindless rabble of orcs. This is the Uruk-hai. Their shield is thick and their armor is broad. Like, he's got battle experience. He knows what's up. So he's like...
Oh, it's comic relief when he can be, but they don't just use him only for comic relief.
They use him for a lot of serious stuff as well.
Yeah, people do underrate Gimli. Yeah. As it would have been cool if they kind of gave him a little bit more just to emphasize how much of an absolute beast he is.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But
the more he gets a lot of screen time in Return of the King, which is good. Which is better. But I like his dynamic. I like his dynamic with – he has got a good dynamic with Eowyn as well, Gimli. Like, it's kind of like this banter /
– There's and a part where he falls off the horse.
Is that in this or is it Return of the King?
It's in this one. He's talking about dwarf women.
That's when they're walking to Helm's Deep.
Right?
Yeah.
It's when he first says, you can't tell because they've got beards as well.
That's what Aragorn says.
That's what Aragorn says. So it is,
That's what
Aragorn says in response. It's the beards.
Gimli's one is like, sometimes they're mistaken for dwarf men. It's like, that's what started the fan following for female dwarves. You've got to see them like have beards and stuff. And they did a good job with Disa.
Ring of Power. Rings of Power, they don't have any beards.
Oh, it's close. You can see Disa having a bit of a sideburn. It's close.
Oh, no.
It's close. But that's cool. Can we talk a bit about Aragorn and Eowyn's dynamic?
Yeah, yeah.
Because I quite enjoy
it. It's very old-fashioned in the sense that she falls in love with him in like a day, but yeah.
Yeah, well, she kind of has a crush on him. Like, I don't know when she finally falls in love. I feel like she does that a bit more.
I don't know if she ever actually does, because I think she does find out that he's...
I think she has a crush on him, if anything.
Yeah.
But I think it makes sense. Like, you think of her situation. her, like, her uncle has gone to shit, her brother's fucked off, her cousin's dead, and as I said, like, everything's hopeless, and then you have this guy ride in, and you realize that these guys are, there's, like, this sense of badassery about them.
Yeah, not just that, but it's also the fact that she is someone who, she's a warrior at heart, right?
Yeah.
She wants to pick up the sword and be a member that's useful to her. And I think what she sees in Aragorn, quickly enough, is that he's everything that kind of she wants in life, to have that valor and that battle experience and that ability to bring hope to men's hearts. And she doesn't just like him for the fact that he's a vagabond. It's like, this is a guy who does what he says he will to help people. And she craves that because she wants to help her people. She can't fight because she's not allowed to. Like, there's that beautiful scene with Aragorn and Eowyn in the hall where she's practicing with the sword, and then Aragorn's like, oh, why are you practicing with the sword? And it's like, well, you know, we still need to know how to use them because we don't want to die upon them, like, by getting attacked. And then Eowyn tells about, her nightmare is not being killed by orcs. Her nightmare is being stuck in a cage where she dies of old age and she has no other use than childbearing. It's like, that's her nightmare. It's like, she wants to be useful. So it's like, whenever someone says, oh, I don't like Lord of the Rings, I don't like watching things that have no women in them and it's just all guys, I'm like, dude, watch The Two Towers, or at least read it or watch it, because Eowyn's character is amazing.
100% inspiration behind George R. R. Martin and his strong female leads.
Brienne of Tarth, yeah. I reckon Brienne of Tarth.
Even just Arya.
Yeah.
Arya, just like, you know, being told that she needs to be like a lady and then her just rebelling. It's not me. Yeah. That's Eowyn.
And when was Two Towers actually released? Again, you said it was the book, you know,
1954.
Okay.
Yeah.
This was if the writing of the book for Eowyn was released in the 50s, way ahead of its time for how Tolkien, like, would have represented a female warrior.
Yeah, when were the suffragettes there in the 70s?
The modern suffragettes, so the whole feminist movement was way later. Like, Tolkien was ahead of his time. So when the film comes out and people are saying, oh, this is full of dudes, I'm like, dude, you don't understand how Tolkien was, when he wrote this stuff, was ahead of his time.
Yeah.
And for them to actually depict a character like Eowyn with Miranda Otto's depiction was really good in Two Towers. It was even better in Return of the King. And it's not just some girl who pines after this dude. She has her own struggle with her uncle and her own struggle with, like, trying to defend her own people. You see a potential, she's technically a princess. She has a struggle trying to lead her people. And it's like, it's not easy. It's not easy at all. So that added dynamic of her kind of, pining after Aragorn, it's done respectfully well. Even after he says, you know, this jewel belongs to an elf maiden who's going after the Undying Lands, she's kind of respectful, but she still has that admiration for him and she still crushes over him.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. It's not like it's not a full, oh, I'm hopelessly in love with you, and then finds out that, he's like in love with some other girl and then she just like crashes and burns. Yeah. It's just like, yeah, I think she finds out that when he sees that, what's it called? Whatever.
The Evanstar.
Yeah.
The little jewel thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's done in a tactful way.
Yeah.
I agree.
On that, there's a couple of things actually we should cover on Aragorn. There's an extended sequence with a horse, the mad horse.
Yeah. Yeah.
That they let go.
Oh, what's his name? Brego.
Brego.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that, I never understood that in the movie because I just thought it was his horse that comes and saves him later on. But it's actually the horse that they deem as being mad and they just let go.
Yeah, I didn't realize they let it go. I thought he always rode that horse. He doesn't. They let that horse go.
Yeah, let that horse go.
His horse at the warg attack on the way to Helm's Deep gets killed. And then when he's on the ravine, this Bruno Brego finds Aragorn.
Isn't Brego the horse of the prince who dies? No?
No, I think it's just horse that was in the stables.
It was a horse that experienced an attack. I don't think it was Théodred's horse.
Yeah.
No, okay.
But it was a horse that was in an attack that was like mad.
Shaken up.
Yeah. And then it comes and saves him and brings him back. And Legolas greets him when he gets back, actually. With the thing on his necklace.
With the Evenstar,
Yeah, and he's like, oh, you're late. I think he says you're late like kind of knew that he was still alive.
Yeah.
And then obviously Gimli also comes and says hi and then
you can't
go from there. Yeah.
He's like, hey. He's like, you are the most reckless, the most stupidest, the most inconsiderate person I've ever knew and I can't believe you're back.
But I just like the exchange that he has with Legolas because it's just this they don't really say anything to each other. Yeah, they just kind of like look at each other.
It's just like, oh, you took your time. You look like shit. It's cool.
Yeah.
It's a nice dynamic.
Oh, also one of the cooler scenes in with these three. It's like, you know, it's often these three, but then there's also three plus one when Gandalf comes in.
Yeah.
So when he comes to, what's that city called? The capital of the
Edoras? The one on the hill?
Yeah.
Edoras.
Yeah. When he comes to Edoras, you know, all the guards are confiscating all their weapons and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the Gandalf is like, oh, you wouldn't – what does he say? He says like
you wouldn't part an old man with his walking stick.
Yeah, yeah, and then when his Worm Tongue's like, you let him keep his staff. It's like that's about – and the best part is he's walking, right? The camera focuses on Gandalf walking towards –
These guys in the background. Aiden.
These guys are just taking out every guard casually. Gimli, Legolas, and Aragorn just delivering the greatest beating on earth.
Yeah.
It's like 3v20 and they absolutely own them.
Nice, yeah.
So and the focus isn't even on that because they focus everything on Gandalf in that.
Yeah.
Because you find out he's white, Gandalf the White then.
Yeah. And also Saruman says something about, you know, Gandalf the Grey, and then he takes off his cloak and he just reveals this light, and then and he's like, I'll weed you like a poison from a
poison from a wound.
It's like, some of these lines are so poetic. It's like, do you know where that comes from? Like poison from a wound. It's the old way of when people got stung,
like suck the they wound
would
out of
suck the poison out of the actual wound. So you got stung by a snake. I mean, the indigenous did it. Right. That was their way of doing it in Australia. They would suck out and spit out the blood. Yeah. So it's like this real, like, I'm going to bleed you out of this guy. You know, it's like this real, like.
Actually, all of Gandalf's lines in that scene are awesome. Like the one where Wormtongue is like.
Gandalf's lines once he gets resurrected just in general, even just before, unbelievably poetic.
Yeah. Oh, it's so good. Like Wormtongue's coming up to him. It's like, you know, Lat spell, I name him. Ill news is an ill guess. What are you doing here? And like, Gandalf's like, be silent. I didn't fight through fire and death to bandy creed words from a witless worm. It's like, dude, that's amazing.
It's just alliteration is everything.
So good.
There's like Gandalf says these lines in, I think it's in Return of the King in the extended edition where he talks about Gondor and kind of, it's like these words that describe Gondor where like the tombs are more expensive or like they spend more money on the tombs of their predecessors. It's like the description of Gondor that he says and even when he's talking to Pippin about how death is merely but another journey, it's just like all these profound poetic lines that are unbelievable and just like descriptions of just the nature of being human, right? Like Tolkien's describing these things that have happened to the ruin of civilization. You know, like Rome was kind of like that and you're spending all this money on the past and on memories rather than the people who are suffering in front of you right now. It's like,
absolutely.
The things that Gandalf says are unreal. And I just watch it every time. I'm like, what the fuck? It's ridiculous.
Which it kind of brings into the fold, like Gandalf's role is to, Gandalf the Grey was meant to unite the hearts of men or unite the hearts of different civilizations, right? That was his role. As Gandalf the White, that becomes much more, you could say, potent. And the urgency is also ramped up. So that's why we see him speaking much more poetically about this because it's now so much more relevant. So, like, this might be a good time to go into Gandalf's arc.
Yeah, I guess, we're on Gandalf at the moment.
Yeah.
And that scene that we were just talking about, I think it's when Saruman realized that he's in a bit of trouble now because Gandalf the White
has returned.
Yeah.
He thought Balrog meant Gandalf's gone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just going back to, when you first saw Two Towers, did you know Gandalf was going to come back?
I didn't know.
I did not know. No, I did not know either.
When the big reveal happens, you know, the White Wizard. Deal.
Yeah.
Everyone's all right. The whole
I thought it was Saruman. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
The White Wizard is Saruman. It's supposed to be Saruman. And then he takes the mantle, right?
Well, I still remember when I was in the theaters watching it, I was still devastated by the fact of Gandalf's death. And this comes back to the very first scene of Two Towers where it opens up and it kind of, you see Misty Mountains, you start hearing lines from Gandalf and the Fellowship. And then it dives into that scene in Moria, Khazad-dûm, on the bridge of Khazad-dûm, where Gandalf's facing the Balrog alone. And you're just sitting there like, I'm watching the sequel to Lord of the Rings. Why am I watching this traumatic moment again? This is devastating. Why am I watching it again? I didn't know I was watching it again. And then you see the same scene, the same music, the same score, and Gandalf falls. Frodo screams a bit early and you see the camera now follows Gandalf through the depths. And it's this is what I mean by the most powerful opening in a film. It just shows him diving into the depths, free fall, fighting the Balrog. He grabs Glamdring on free fall, like the blade that was forged in Gondolin, and he's fighting a Balrog falling through the air. And I'm like, this is insane. I thought he died the moment he fell. He didn't die. He was fighting the Balrog and he's just dueling this thing.
In that scene, the Balrog's like massive, right? The Balrog is bloody huge.
It's huge.
And also in the lore of Lord of the Rings, it's kind of like an equivalent to them, like, because these wizards are Maia, right?
Maia, yeah.
And so
and Balrog are Maia.
Are Maia as well. So yeah. They're like, they're equals. They're not, it's not just some random monster.
Well, they're equals in the sense that a Balrog Maia spirit is like, it's uncontrolled shadow and flame. And it's Sauron is also a Maia spirit. That's why he's really like, he's hot to touch. And that's how he kills Celebrimbor, like with flames. Gandalf, though, because he's Istari, Gandalf specifically can use fire in a more productive way. So he's got the flame of Udun that he can use.
And also technically he wears the ring. He's supposed to wear the ring of fire. Yeah.
True. Even before he wore the ring.
One of the three.
Even before he wore the ring, he had that ability to kind of use particular brands. But he's here fighting the Balrog and it's just so amazing.
There's that scene where, what I was trying to allude to, Balrog's huge and Gandalf's small than Balrog, right? Yeah. And then they fall. And then there's that scene where it's like this massive, it's not a close-up. It's like from far away.
Yeah, the chasm. Like the chasm.
Yeah, and they fall into the chasm and they're tiny.
Yep.
But
yep.
Then the flame just lights the whole canyon up.
And I see it. Chasm up.
Yeah. And it's like, that's such it's a cool just scene.
Visually, I was going to say, that's the most visually spectacular opening to a movie.
It just
ever.
Gives you the scale of everything that they're going
through. And it's all dark and you just see it light up and you just see it sort of light up. As they're falling down.
And the fight just keeps going. Like, that's not the end of it. They end up on the bloody top of the mountain somehow. Like,
in the snow.
Some crazy shit.
The amazing thing is, none of this is in the books, right? This whole battle of him, Gandalf falling down, none of it's in the books. The whole thing.
Is it?
Well, the what inspired this whole scene was, so there's two principal artists that work in making the art for this film, John Howe and Alan Lee. They were the ones who did most of the artwork for the books. And for most of Tolkien's Legendatum, Peter Jackson brought them over from, England, the US. John Howe did a small artwork of Gandalf fighting the Balrog in free fall for like Middle Earth, the card game or something. And he had it on his office. Peter Jackson looked at that and he goes, oh, we have to make a scene of that.
Yeah.
So this whole scene, this whole sequence was inspired off of one drawing and it's so cool.
Some of the drawings that people have for this lore is unbelievable, right? Like now it's everywhere, but the way they do it as well, and I think
it's insane. Yeah, and most of that comes from John Howe and Alan Lee. So the really descriptive and like 90% of their artwork was used to inspire most of the creations of the Blackgate or Minas Tirith or even just the wraiths how they're depicted. But you know that scene where we're just talking about how they both come down to the cavern. I'd love to bring the score into this moment, right? So there's a channel on YouTube. It's an amazing channel. It actually goes into the lyrics of the score.
Is
the orchestra.
Man of the West? No, it's not.
No, it's not Man of the West. I think it's like behind the score or the score analysis of Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
The score has its own story. Like the chorus, they're singing their own lines in Quenya and Sindarin. And it's got this parallel storyline that the score is saying. So as they're coming through the cavern, right, the score suddenly broadens into a great rolling chords, mixed chorus, aggregating low strings. And it's one final assault. The words in Quenya are basically saying, to the end, servant to fire, finish the fight. That's the words that are writing. Metana Narendo, which is Gandalf's name in Quenya. So it's so cool seeing how, like, even then, the chorus is pounding the message that your role is not finished, right? To the end. Keep going to the end. That doesn't mean to your death. It means beyond that. Your role is not yet finished on Middle-earth. You see that, it just flashes into Frodo's dream, so you're kind of left, did that happen? That's when you first get the spark of, like, is Gandalf actually dead?
No.
Everyone thinks he's dead. And then you see they're kind of building up to the white wizard in the forest. You don't know, is Saruman going to capture Merry and Pippin?
But I'm pretty sure the lore states, or there is a reference in the lore, in Silmarillion, whatever, that says that Gandalf was sent from Iluvatar. How do you say the name? Iluvatar.
Iluvatar.
Iluvatar was literally sent to solve the problem of Sauron. And so as the power of Sauron rises, he is sent to Middle Earth. That is like the kind of, and then they kind of leave it at that. So whether he knows or not is another question. But and so like, and it comes up to like, your role is not done yet. This is, and then he talks about how it's after this that he talks about how he was like, his mind was in like pure light or space. Or
yeah, straight out of, like, this is when he finally slayed the Balrog on top of Zidak Zigil.
Yeah.
And then you just see him lying down and he fades out of thought and time. Stars wheeled above. He kind of describes himself going through some time, a weird time lapse.
Yeah.
I think he's describing his essence going back into Valinor. This happens with a couple of characters in the Tolkien Legendarium. They die in sacrifice. Glorfindel, for example, he dies almost the exact same way Gandalf dies, fighting a Balrog, falling to the depths, defeating it on the fall of Gondolin. He actually got Glorfindel's brought back to Middle-earth in a much more enlightened form. Similar to what happens to Gandalf. So he's brought back.
Yeah.
And he says this, he's brought back until his task is done. You don't know who brings him back or for what purpose, but you kind of get the feel that there's a will beyond that of evil here.
Mm. Yeah.
Which is something we touched on in the first podcast.
Yes.
Nice.
Yes.
Yeah.
And about mysteries not necessarily having a solution.
Correct.
Keeping things open-ended.
So like that reunion with Gandalf is really kind of cathartic.
Yes.
Because you see the trio as well. It's like they don't know it's him.
Yeah, and Legolas thinks it's Saruman. Yeah. I think because he says something before they.
He says something about the white wizard.
Is it the white wizard approaches and then, do not let him speak. He'll put a spell on us.
Yeah, that's right.
That's
right.
Correct.
Yeah.
So they all attack him with ranged weapons.
And then he deflects them.
Holy shit, dude.
He's pretty good. And then
he actually doesn't remember his name because Aragorn calls him Gandalf. But then he's like, oh, that's what they used to
call
him. I'm not sure how. I don't remember if that was in the books. But I feel like they're kind of suggesting that Gandalf had a journey that just passed all time to the point where he even forgot who he was, which explains a lot. He slowly starts remembering, oh, yeah, Frodo. Oh, yeah, Sam. Because later on down the track, he's just like, he's talking to Aragorn. It's like, you know, Frodo will need to do this journey alone and correctly. And Aragorn's like, he's not alone. Sam went with him. Like, oh.
Oh yeah,
I forgot about him. He's just like, for a second, he's just like, he went with him. That's good. he's coming back a bit.
And his entrance in Helm's Deep is pretty great.
Look for me on the fifth day or in the...
Oh, you mean in the final battle?
Yes.
When he brings the Rohirrim.
He brings the Rohirrim and basically is a Deus Ex Machina to save the whole troop. That's amazing.
And that's when the game, Return of the King starts.
Return of the
Helm's Deep.
I think that imagery is etched into my mind because you see Aragorn look up at the window and you see the light coming through.
And then
you see Gandalf.
In the game.
And in the movie.
I remember this scene because of the game. The game starts off this way. I've played that game so many times that I just remember. You just look to me on the whatever day it is.
Fourth light of the fifth day.
At
dawn to the east. So that was... And it kind of comes to that home. When he says that, it just sounds so profound. Like, how are you so precise? It goes back to saying wizards are never late or early. They arrive precisely when they mean to.
Yes.
So he's driving this essence of like, you know, Mithrandir or Gandalf will appear at the right time to rekindle the hopes of men. And in this case, literally to rekindle the hopes of all these soldiers who have been fighting at Helm's Deep and the elves who came to Helm's Deep and were all slaughtered. Because of their valiant efforts. Wasn't in the books, but I think it actually is a really good detail to have them in the movie.
Oh, it's not in the books.
No, the elves never come. Helm's Deep in the books is just like
elves a never give a fuck.
that's the thing that like they never come to the aid of Helm's Deep because this is another battle that doesn't concern them. But in the movies, they actually do send them out. Lorien sends out their warriors, and in the movies originally, Arwen was going to be in Helm's Deep, fighting alongside Aragorn. They actually filmed a lot of it.
Oh, really?
They had Arwen's stunt double and Arwen in red costume, red and black, fighting with her, you know, Half-Hadang and everything. But they, I think rightfully so, cut it out because they were thinking, how do we reconnect Arwen and Aragorn to have their
because she has a parallel storyline where she's being sent off, right? And then she's having
she's supposed to go back to
Elrond's trying to tell her, you know.
Well, like every elf does that though, right? They eventually return because they're immortal.
Yeah. Well, it's their last chance to go back and it's like the time of the elves is ending. And he's telling Arwen, you can stay here if you want, if you have hope, but you still have to taste the bitterness of mortality. And if Aragorn has become king and everything that happens you want is happens, you'll still have to bury him. He'll still die and you'll be like youthful and ageless and you'll have to wander this earth alone. And it's like, he's not wrong, but he's leaving out a lot of stuff in between that might happen, which you'll see in Return of the King. But poor Arwen is just like, doesn't know what to do. And she's obviously kind of really conflicted. But yeah, she was meant to be in Helm's Deep in the movie. Thankfully, she wasn't. That would have been a bit too much, I think.
Anything else on Helm's Deep? That one Uruk-hai that runs in with the bomb
Oh, the Berserker.
Yeah, Berserker.
That's
carrying the Olympic torch.
That whole Helm's Deep as a siege is so beautifully done. That was the first proper siege scene I've ever seen in cinema.
Yeah,
done amazingly well. That whole Berserker scene about destroying the wall and bringing it up.
Yeah,
it's like Legolas gets him twice. He still runs. It just shows how tough this particular Berserker is.
He doesn't just run, he goes flying.
Jumps in. And Legolas has that scene where he, does a skateboard with
shield surfs
and
the thing.
And then he chucks the shield.
Which I'm sure Tolkien fans will love. Tolkien himself will be rolling in his grave, but that was it.
I think that was good. And then in the Hobbit trilogy, they took it a little bit too far.
The Hobbit trilogy. Is why was he? He's not supposed to be in that trilogy.
Yeah, it's not.
Why?
It's supposed to be like a Merkwood.
Why? It's stupid.
Yeah.
So the whole shield surfing thing, you know where it came from? The director of photography, the guy who was filming that scene, is like, I love taking my family snowboarding. So it'd be cool if Legolas did a snowboarding scene where he's shield surfing down and shooting the seeds. And it wasn't until I was playing Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild that I was shield surfing. Scoping orcs out of my sight. I'm like, oh, you know what? I understand this. I'm glad they kept that scene. It's a cool scene. Helm's Deep is a battle all together. Yeah. Just mind blowing. The build up, the tension, the whole scene where all the elves are dead, Haldir gets slain. Mm. It's just this like beautiful depiction of the mortality of the elves. Like
if an elf gets caught in slow motion, they're about to die. That's what happens all the time.
Yeah,
it's sadder when an elf dies because they're meant to live forever. Yeah. And they're sacrificing their lives and they're dying, like all youthful faces in the crowd. They're all like lying in the mud with the blood coming out of them. Haldir is just like looking at the end of his days. It's sad. It's really sad. But it's like this never happened in the book. So he's Two Towers is adding on that lore.
All right. Mm-hmm. Pippin and Merry. So I think we've kind of covered up to the part they go into the forest. So once they go into the forest, they meet Treebeard. Things slow down.
By accident. They're trying to escape this orc.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And then there's a whole bunch of scenes that are in the extended edition where they're like drinking water from this forest.
And drafting that. But the bulk of the scenes with Merry and Pippin with the Treebeard is that Treebeard's holding Merry and Pippin. And for the first part, he doesn't know if they're orcs or what they are. They're trying to say, well, hobbits, we're friendly. Yeah. And he's just like, oh, I don't trust you. I never met a hobbit and it sounds like orc mischief and they come with axes and they cut us. He's just on this rant and he's just like, I want nobody's side because no one's on my side. And it's like, I've never related to a character before in my life that strongly. he's a true, what do you call it?
But he's like, it sounds like he's one of those, I think what he was trying to depict was the people that were probably old in the pre-World War One era. I'm talking about the Prussian War that happened in 1900 and like, all these battle-hardened fucks that were, they're there, but they've been through it all. They've been through this crazy thing and therefore they believe no one is for them, that nothing, they can't relate to anyone else and they're always suspicious of everyone else. I think that's kind of, there's always people like that, There's people who have been through so much trauma, they've been through so much crap that they trust no one else. I think that's kind of what maybe that's where the inspiration Tolkien got.
That's very interesting because I always thought the inspiration for Treebeard was literal nature. Like he saw the devastation of war that had on like nature, like trees, plants.
Well, yeah.
Like trench warfare, you had to actually raise entire fields, dig trenches that would destroy all wildlife.
But to me, I think the most important line in Lord of the Rings is said by Merry, which is, I'm probably misquoting here, but it's after they've had their meeting and all this sort of shit and they're like, these wars don't concern us, Ents or whatever, he says. And then Merry's question is, but are you not a part of this world? And it's like, that's just like, that is such an important question to ask because it's kind of like, it's a question you got to ask yourself just all the time. Like, why do you care about the problems of other people?
Yeah.
And like, if you're a part of this community, if you're another human being that can empathize with someone else, then that's what it's worth. Are you not a part of this world? Why do you not care? And then it's such an important question. And then eventually the fact that I think it's Pippin that tells him to go via the area where they've cut down Fanghorn.
And that's enough,
at least in the movies, to then bring like this. It's like rage, isn't it? It's rage, but he says like I knew these. Like, these people are my friends.
And yeah, like all the trees
are ripped out and they all come.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's like so sad as well. You're like, oh my God.
It's like, that line is so good. Like, there is no curse in Elvish, Entish, or the tongues of men for this treachery. Yeah. And then he just basically channels, he calls all the Ents and they march.
And he says, and it's just like, he said a wizard should know better.
Yeah, yeah. A wizard, because their role is to.
From memory,
because
they should know. They should know what kind of. What is holy and what are lines that should not be crossed? And you would think that a Maia or whatever would know how important that is. I think that's what they're alluding to.
Yeah.
And the fact that like Saruman has done this is like that line. I was like, oh my God, there's some like profound lines here that refer to law and like meaning and what is like something you just should not do.
That's true.
It's like going beyond the scope of all evil and like destroying things that. Just nature, right? Destroying nature is like this, is like so unnecessary.
Well, destroying nature is one thing, but destroying nature for warfare, that industrialization, which we talked about, Saruman, like Isengard, everything from the music of Isengard to the theme and the factory and all that, it's just all about burning, destroying
wood. Well, so the music is literally a hammer. It's like, dun 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 dun. And it's literally just someone just.
Hammering an anvil. Yeah, it's nuts. It's purposeful. Everything is intentional. Like the music was scored in 5/4 time. It's meant to be this very unsettling beat, like you're thinking of an anvil being struck.
But 5/4 once again. It's so the music in itself, it doesn't symmetrically keep repeating.
No.
It's asymmetrical in its repetition. And so you're like caught off guard. You're like, fuck, this is even the music's just evil. It shouldn't have been even written in this way.
You bring on this really cool topic. This is one of the biggest motifs of Two Towers. It's not an obvious motif, but it's the reclamation of nature, right? And I think this, like anyone who's ever like felt for the environment or, you know, nature or wildlife or just trees in general, this is the film where they actually have their chance to get something back or to plot their revenge. And it's not just in the Ents storyline. It's the whole fact of like, ever since like Gandalf comes back into the scene, he starts commenting on like, oh, these trees are going to wake up. They're going to find them. They're going to see that they're strong. But all elements of nature are slowly kind of finding their power. Like when Gandalf comes out of the forest and he calls Shadowfax.
Yes.
And Shadowfax, that's one of my favorite scenes in this movie. Like that
that scene, they did it in one take.
This blows my mind.
How the hell did you horse train? Like, that's nuts.
Because I could have sworn from the moment I saw that scene when I was a kid, that beautiful long shot of the horse coming in and coming to Gandalf and like literally bowing its head when its name is called. I thought it was, they must have like graphically altered a shot or done this. Like the feet don't look right. It wasn't until I saw it in high definition that I'm like, this is real. All that's real. The horse was real. The thing was real. And
what does he call him? Like the Lord of all horses.
Lord of all horses. And Legolas is obviously like, that is one of the Meras. Unless my eyes are cheated by some spell. Like, again, he's natural.
Man,
his natural
Legolas inside. Is into horse porn. Nah, but it's cool.
It's that, and even the score is basically saying this is the Lord of all horses. And it's like, I love that concentration on nature, right? It focuses on that. And then the trees, obviously, like the Ents finding.
And also the solution to it is like, They break a dam, right? Which is also like you're breaking the unnatural holding of water, right? You're letting a river flow. That's it. You're letting nature just do its thing.
Yep, yep. And it completely decimates all of the factories and the setup in Isengard.
Who says, is it Gandalf or someone says when the forest will be woken? Is it Gandalf that says it?
Yeah, it's when he's talking to like Aragorn, Gimli, and Legolas, and.
When they're in the forest.
When they're in the forest, because
they still have a purpose.
Something's about to happen that has not happened for an age. The trees are going to wake up and they find out they're strong. And then Gimli's like, strong? Oh, that's good. It's like,
yeah, that's what it is. Yeah.
He probably has his stupid laugh.
Oh, man. Yeah. And when the Ents march, the last march of the Ents, that theme, like, which is headed up by one of the boys' choir, you hear that theme first in Fellowship of the Ring. When like the camera's going across Isengard and a small moth flies towards Gandalf, you hear like a lone choir. Yeah. That's the first time you hear the reclamation of nature theme. And it doesn't come into full power until this scene in Last March of the Ents. Where it's full
it's the nature. So it's the theme that comes up with the moth, with the eagles, with the Ents.
Yep.
And then it'll come back to when the eagles pick them up in the mountain right at the end. It's just whenever it's this magical nature sort of.
Yeah. It's really a beautiful really motif of the films. Yeah. And I love the Two Towers for at least exploring that side of, you know, trees kicking us, you know?
Yeah.
Coming back. And That scene itself, Tolkien was inspired from reading Macbeth. There's a line in Macbeth where the forest.
I was about to say, is this a Macbeth? Yeah,
it's a Macbeth theme. But he was so disappointed by the theatrical display of it. It was just a bunch of kids wearing twigs on their heads, pretending to be the forest. And he was just so disappointed. He's like, I'm going to write a better scene than this.
Yeah.
He just furiously wrote this whole scene of the forest marching to Helm's Deep. And they depicted that in the extended edition, which is really
cool. Because what do they say at the battle of, they say, is it Duncan? No, it's Duncan or whatever in Macbeth. He's like, oh, you'll only be defeated when the forest of something comes to the castle wall. That's what Shakespeare wrote or whatever. And that's kind of, it's a big reference.
Big reference. He's a huge Shakespeare fan, Tolkien. Yeah. So
I mean, who else are you a fan? If you're English, who else do you?
That is true.
If you're English and you're in the bloody
1900s.
Early 1900s, who else you got, bro? Tolkien would, the only other person he could be inspired by was himself.
Yeah.
He's next. Him and C.S. Lewis are next.
Yeah, that's true.
And then you start getting all the good writers as well.
Yeah.
The rest.
And while we're still on the topic of Treebeard and the ants, props to the graphics department. They've really made Treebeard was believably good. Like the CGI, I think it's because they actually built a 2-scale animatronic of Treebeard and they did CGI on top of that.
Mm.
So
the movement looks like stilted. It looks like a tree's walking, essentially. Yep. Yeah.
Essentially, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's funny, Merry and Pippin were basically seated on these big, like metal prosthetic animatronic hands, but they were sitting on bicycle seats that were backwards. So it really hurt their balls in one area. You could see, and that's one of their like most painful memories of sitting in there. It's so good. Dominic Monaghan and Billy Boyd. Yeah.
Ooh, are there any other parties that are involved? They have this scene at the end in the extended edition where
they get food from the
which is funny because technically that means that, so is there any other human apart from Wormtongue that's in the Tower of Isengard? They're not shown in,
it's just Saruman.
And so are you telling me Saruman has this massive fuck off kitchen where he's just making all these turkeys and shit? Like,
it's and so Longbottom Leaf, and he's smoking weed, which he lambasted Gandalf on doing. So I'm pretty sure he's getting high.
But also, Tolkien said it's not weed; it's actually nicotine. He's actually said it.
Oh, okay.
Nicotania.
Yeah. So it's like tobacco leaf, but they call it Longbottom Leaf, which is like
the best. Yeah, what pipe they call weed. It? The best pipe weed in South Fair.
South Farthing.
South Farthing.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
Anyway, they just smoke a storm and eat all this random shit. And they say that, no, we shouldn't tell Treebeard. Could be one of his relatives and all.
Yeah. That's true. That's funny.
Yeah.
That is funny. Oh, that's good.
And it ends with that.
Yeah.
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 Well, it ends with, extended edition ends with.
Well, extended, it ends with Gollum and
Frodo. Well, no, extended edition with Saruman's story ends with him dying. No, that's
it. That's Return of the King. Yeah. Opening of Return of the King. It's different.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So it ends on Gollum.
Ends on Gollum. Yeah. The only party we haven't covered, I think, is Theoden.
Yes.
Specifically his own little arc.
Yeah, yeah. I will say the scene where you see his transformation, and it's all one shot.
It's dope.
It's
pretty crazy.
So they had to do multiple shots. One of Bernard Hill, who's the guy who acts as Theoden, wearing the full makeup prosthetics. Then they did another shot with him wearing mid-level beard, and then one with him wearing
and then sort of transitioned it.
What does he say? He also has this amazing line when he gets converted, when he comes back to normal.
Yeah.
What does he say? He has like,
dark have been my dreams.
Sure, I knew you'd know the line. Yeah. Some of these lines are incredible. Yeah.
So well written.
Yeah. What does he say?
Dark have been my dreams of late. And then Gandalf's like, you're old. He's like, he's holding his fingers. And then Gandalf is like, your hands would remember their old strength best if they were to grasp your sword. And then like, you know, a gambling is giving him a sword. Not gambling, sorry, his other right hand. And then the music when he picks up his sword. Beautiful. Like the violins they used were specifically from like the Nordic regions of like Iceland. They had these.
Well, the way they made town is very Viking. So like this township and then having this big king's hut at the top is like so Viking. That's how all Viking towns
work. And all of the woodwork, they use like Celtic interlaced artistry to make it look very Celtic origin, Anglo-Saxon origin, and Tolkien based Rohan and the kingdom of Rohan off of Beowulf, which is a very Anglo-Saxon inspired mythical tale.
Yeah, Beowulf was his direct inspiration.
Inspiration. Yeah,
that was
the
first thing he did. Was he translate one of his
all the names like Eomer?
First thing
Eowyn,
Tolkien did was do a translation of Beowulf. I think is one of his first pieces of writing. And then
a lot of
I don't understand anything about Beowulf. I think it's like, I don't know much about it in some early mythology, but
it's a much more connected mythology, I guess you could say. It's not as fantastical.
Yeah.
But yeah. So like the whole kingdom of Rohan, you're bought into it. Like the fact that they chose such an amazing location like Edoras and they found this place. By the way, every shot you see in Two Towers that's got like Edoras with mountains in the back, it's not CGI. That's the real deal. Mm-hmm. And that's the one thing where people are like, oh, I don't know if that's real anymore. It's genuine. It's good stuff. So you have, like I was saying, the culture of Rohan, we get the first insight into culture of the Ithilien Rangers, Isengard, obviously, Mordor, Uruk-hai, and Orcs. Easterlings, right? The men of the East. You have the Harad. You see people with like the Southrons and the Oliphants. Then you've got the elves of Lorien come as well halfway through. And you see the hobbits and whatnot. There's so many cultures in this film. This is like an all-inclusive, a full expose of all the peoples of Middle-earth. It's pretty diverse. It's awesome.
Dope stuff.
It's good. I think we covered every character. I
think so.
This is like 2 hours long.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a lot of behind-the-scenes detail and things that people went through and all that kind of stuff. I literally went through and I wrote down all the lyrics from the score, like moments where the choir was singing in some elven script.
I find it crazy that he created his own elven languages and dwarf languages. He has his own, like, the language of Mordor.
Yeah.
Which is in itself like this.
Yeah, it's so cool.
Visceral thing.
Like, that depth comes from a linguist. Like, if he wasn't a linguist, you wouldn't find that depth.
Yeah.
It's
really interesting in The Hobbit, the way they made Benedict Cumberbatch do the shadow, what do they call it? The shadow speak or whatever. Whatever, when he's speaking the dark tongue.
Yeah, yeah. When he's Smaug?
No, when he's Sauron. When he does Sauron in Dusseldorf, whatever. He's the voice of Sauron.
Benedict Cumberbatch?
Yeah.
In Lord of the Rings?
No, in The Hobbit.
Oh, in The Hobbit. In The Hobbit. Oh, in Dol Guldur. Yeah.
He does the voice, but what he does is he has what he needs to say. He says it in reverse and then they reverse that. To make it sound so visceral and really fucked up.
Yeah, black speech.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, side point.
Yeah, we've pretty much covered everything. I've got two pieces of trivia. So body count. We talked about this in Fellowship. What do you think the body count was in Two Towers?
Oh, the total body count?
Yeah. Is it how many people got fucked?
Okay, so it's going to be – it's got to be more than 10,000 because all the Uruks die. I'm going to say
– All the Uruks from Isengard die.
Yeah. Which is 10,000 strong. So I'm going to say that plus all the elves. Oof, it's got to be something like, I'm going to say something 15,000.
I have no clue. Yeah, sure.
So someone's, again, I think this is underestimated. So officially on IMDb, it's 469.
That's it?
Yeah.
469?
Yeah.
Okay. No, but the deaths you see on screen.
On screen. I think that's
screen.
What.
Yeah, on screen.
On screen
deaths.
On screen deaths. Okay. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
On screen, yeah.
That's interesting. That's pretty cool still, the 469 deaths. That's some pretty gruesome deaths.
Yes, yeah.
Like that orc that gets torn up.
Yeah.
Because the orc blocks meat.
Back on the menu, boys.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, they tear him up and his intestines go flying.
And lastly, Peter Jackson's children, Billy Jackson and Kay Jackson, appear as cute Rohan refugee children.
Nice. Interesting.
The ones that are actually in the scene get told, that mum tells
the kids.
I don't think it's them.
No, I don't think it's them.
I think you just see him in the background.
Yeah. That's cool.
That's it.
And Viggo, one small tidbit was obviously all the actors gave their all for this film. Some people, like Viggo Mortensen, almost died 3 times in this one.
Jeez.
When he was in the river and stuff and that kind of stuff. So in his makeup booth, in his makeup trailer, above his mirror, he had the motto, adapt and overcome. And that was the one mantra that he would basically live on day in, day out, apparently, according to his makeup artists and Orlando Bloom and all the stunt
this
teams.
This is like early Orlando Bloom, isn't it?
It's his second movie.
Second movie straight up.
Yeah.
He was in Straight Bangers.
Yeah. And then, but has he been in any good movies since?
Pirates?
I guess.
Apart
from those, not really.
Not really, right?
Yeah.
But it's, man, what a film. What a journey. And that final monologue by Sam at the end?
Yes.
That's amazing.
Actually, there was a piece of trivia about that. So that wasn't going to be how they ended the movie.
Yeah.
And there's another thing that Sam says, actually. By rights, we shouldn't even be here. That was meant to be the last line that he says. And that's a nod to the book as well, because in the book, they don't actually go to Osgiliath.
Yeah. No. They don't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, where do they get to in
So they pass straight through, apparently, in the books. I haven't read this far.
They just get to Innes.
I feel like they skirt Mordor, essentially. They don't go into Osgiliath.
So that was a deviation, and they kind of nodded to that in the dialogue.
And was it Sean Austin who wanted to actually say more in that monologue? So he actually asked Philippa Boyens if he could say more but about the situation instead of just ending it on that line. And they actually had that beautiful monologue of him saying, you know, because there's some good in this world and it's worth fighting for. Like, that's why people keep going.
Yes, yes.
And for like Elijah Wood is like, well, what are we holding on to, Sam? And Sam's like, yeah, because there's some good in this world. And it's like, that's a really powerful line.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
Yeah. And doesn't he talk about how they're going to tell stories about their journey and Frodo? And then Frodo's like, oh, they're forgetting one of the main heroes, which is Sam.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's right before the end.
Right before this. Yeah.
That's right. And also that scene is when Faramir finally sees what is going on with Frodo. And Sam, like, says, can you not see what it's doing to him? Like, that's when, like, Faramir actually kind of, he proves that he's, like, he understands, like, a higher purpose. He understands, which Boromir couldn't do. Boromir was, like, short-sighted in that he could only see that the ring could achieve something. But Faramir then just pulls back a bit and he's like, I understand. And he lets them go. And he tells them how.
And he also gives Gollum a very stern warning as well before he lets them go.
Yeah. There's one detail I do know. Gollum
clearly doesn't give a fuck about his opinion.
Faramir in the books doesn't have such an arc. He's always even keeled and good. But in the movies, they intentionally made him come close to the evil side so they can give him a good redemption arc.
And in the extended scenes, he gets a redemption, doesn't he? In the next movie.
Yeah. He does. Oh, but in Return of the King is one of those films where in the extended editions, it doesn't actually, apart from Gandalf in the very beginning where he takes down Saruman,
he's
not much different.
He's like shown to be with Eowyn. Yeah. What's her name?
Eowyn.
Eowyn.
But you see that in theatrical as well.
Yeah, in the theatrical.
No, I thought it's only extended.
And there's a drawn-out scene in extended, but towards a theatrical edition, the very end.
You just see them together.
In the coronation, you see them together and they're both looking lovingly. Oh, they're going to get married. It's like, yeah, that's cool. They deserve each other.
Yeah, until you realize Faramir's gay. Who knows? He could be. How do you know?
Hey, it's an open textbook. It's open to interpretation.
Exactly.
All right. So I think that brings us to the end of Two Towers. So we've only got Return of the King left.
Two Towers, best movie of the trilogy. No. Start of Return of the King is also amazing. I like the first half of Return of the King. Second half, obviously, whatever. It's too much Frodo and Sam for me.
Okay.
I think I would actually, after watching Two Towers, I would say right now I'm in that mood. It's slightly better than Fellowship. Fellowship has some amazing moments, but Two Towers builds upon that and still comes out strong.
Yeah, and I think everything we've discussed, there's obviously a lot more depth than I first intended there to be in Two Towers. Mm. The stuff around nature and all of that, that's very interesting.
It's all hidden. There's so much in there.
So much in there. I'm sure when I listen to this podcast – You know, in a couple of weeks' time,
I don't listen to this podcast.
I'll be like, we didn't talk about this or we didn't talk about that. I'm going to forget something. But it's just like, that's the great thing about these things. You can never stop talking about them.
Yeah, that's right.
But we have to at some point. Otherwise, this is going to get way too long.
It is so long already.
Apologies if I did sign a bit fast. That wasn't sped up. That's my natural tempo. So I need to control how fast I talk sometimes.
Well, I listen to the podcast at 1.5 anyway. Like all podcasts. Either 1.25 or 1.5, so. So maybe you might just have to listen to this at one time.
So. All right. So if you want to get in touch with us about your thoughts on Lord of the Rings.
Comment on TikToks and verbally abuse everyone involved.
You can
everyone. Abuse everyone. Yes.
You can definitely do that. Or you can send us an email on cognitiverecalibrationpodcast@gmail.com.
Wait, do the song.
No.
Do the cover. Do the cover.
I'll release a remix.
If we get 100,000 views on the next Cognitive Recal TikTok, we'll have to remix Busker's song.
We'll do
Busker can redo this.
Who knows?
Song.
It might even appear on iTunes.
Perfect. You get absolutely stung by copyright.
Oh my god!
All right, and obviously we're on Twitter, TikTok, Instagram. Follow us on all of those. Stay tuned for TikToks and reels.
Are you going to get on YouTube soon?
Soon. Yeah. We're going to post the full episodes on YouTube in video format.
Yeah.
So, stay tuned for that.
And where's Taron?
Good question.
He's got COVID.
He's watching Return of the King.
He's got COVID.
Yeah, so he'll be returning for Return of the King. So, thanks Bhaskar and Kuri, thanks for joining us.
No worries.
It's a pleasure as always. Thanks for having us.
It was good fun. It was nice.
We'll see when we do Return of the King. First, we've got to watch it. So we've got to – it's yes. a big planning process just to watch these and then record these.
It takes a whole day. Yeah. It's I don't know how people do marathons, man.
And what, Rings of Power coming up? Review?
Following Return of the King will be Rings of Power.
Yeah, we might have to do it in two episodes or something, or three.
Four Rings of Power?
Four Rings of Power, yeah, maybe. We'll see.
If there's
enough. Are we keen to join? We'll see.
Yeah.
Hopefully. Maybe it'll be after my exam, so yeah, probably join.
Yeah. I'm keen.
All right. Well, you got all that to look forward to. And then after our Lord of the Rings, we're on a bit of a Lord of the Rings thing at the moment, but after that we've got...
We can review the MCU after that.
Yeah. Well, we will get
triggered by this.
We will have She-Hulk, which will...
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Also finish around that time, and then...
It doesn't take long to review She-Hulk.
Not if we get you on. And then... Black Panther is in November. Black Adam is in October. Nice. So other comic book stuff coming up. So
nice.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Hope you're all staying safe, and we'll see you in the next one.
Catch you guys. Take care.
Catch you later.